President Trump says he's accepted the resignation of Scott Pruitt, the embattled head of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's Thursday, July 5th, and this is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker. Coming up this hour, we'll have more on Scott Pruitt's resignation today. Also, NPR's Nina Totenberg about the three people on President Trump's Supreme Court shortlist. And in a Virginia county where the coal industry once thrived, jobs are now scarce.
There's just nothing here. You're fighting 50 other people on a list a mile long to get a minimum wage job anymore. I mean, you get a job, you keep it because you know you got to.
And Philadelphia has formally ended the practice of segregating male and female swimmers at public pools. It's 4:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The long-embattled head of the Environmental Protection Agency is on his way out. NPR's Nathan Rott reports President Trump tweeted a short time ago that he has accepted Scott Pruitt's resignation.
Scott Pruitt came to the EPA with a deregulatory agenda. He promised to carry out many of President Trump's campaign promises, doing away with Obama-era regulations like the Clean Power Plan, which was meant to address climate change, and waters of the U.S. Pruitt delivered from a policy perspective, launching the long process of removing or redoing some of those policies, which garnered him praise from Republicans and industry. But ethical lapses were his undoing. Pruitt was accused of traveling in luxury, taking a sweetheart housing deal from a lobbyist, and of misspending taxpayer money on 24-hour security and a $43,000 soundproof phone booth. Those issues sparked numerous investigations. Andrew Wheeler, a former coal lobbyist, is expected to replace Pruitt, likely carrying on a similar agenda. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
President Trump's list of possible Supreme Court nominees is down to three. Sources tell NPR the frontrunners are Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and Amy Coney Barrett on the Seventh Circuit. Raymond Kethledge on the Sixth Circuit is also reported to be on that list. The Trump administration is attempting to comply with court orders to start reuniting migrant families who were separated at the U.S. border with Mexico under a zero-tolerance policy. Today, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced that children under the age of five who've been in the care of HHS will be returned to their parents starting next Tuesday. Azar briefed reporters today.
We face an evolving situation that is partly born out of years of congressional failures to fix our immigration system, but also by courts stepping in to apply their own interpretations, which are in conflict with one another.
Nearly 12,000 migrant children are in the care of HHS. A majority of them are unaccompanied minors. Two more people are hospitalized in critical condition in Britain after being exposed to the Cold War-era nerve agent Novichok. It's the same toxin that nearly killed a former Russian spy and his daughter in March in Salisbury, the same place where the latest victims were sickened. NPR's Alice Fordham has an update from London.
Following an emergency meeting of high-level officials, Interior Minister Sajid Javid told lawmakers two more people had been poisoned by Novichok near the town of Salisbury, where a former Russian agent and his daughter were exposed to the nerve agent and nearly died earlier in the year. Javid blamed Russia for both incidents.
It is now time that the Russian state comes forward and explains exactly what has gone on.
Members of Parliament sought assurances that members of the public would be safe. Javid and the police do not know how the two came into contact with the substance, which remains potent for months and can be fatal even in very small quantities. Alice Fordham, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker in Boston. The mayor of Boston says he's angry about the 4th of July shootings in Dorchester that killed one man and hurt four others. WBUR's Quincy Walters reports.
Officials are urging anyone with information about the shootings to come forward. One happened near a party where kids were playing in a bounce house. Mayor Marty Walsh says the people responsible jeopardized young, innocent lives.
If you want to kill each other, it's a horrible thing, and I don't want to stand here as mayor and say, you know, we're justifying that. You kill each other. But what happens is you kill an innocent person, and you disrupt a whole community, and you send the wrong message to young people. And the thing that's frustrating about it, not one of them are talking.
So far, there have been no arrests. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Quincy Walters.
Lawyers for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev want access to interview recordings with a man who was killed in a confrontation with the FBI. The recordings involve authorities questioning Ibrahim Todashev in 2013 about a triple murder that took place in Waltham in 2011. Authorities say Todashev confessed that he participated in those murders with Tsarnaev's older brother, Tamerlan. No one has ever been charged in the triple murders. Todashev was killed by an FBI agent after that interview. Agents said they shot him after he charged at them with a metal broom. An 8-year-old girl and her mother, who were separated after crossing the U.S. border, have been reunited in Boston. The ACLU of Massachusetts sued on behalf of the mother, Angelica Gonzalez-Garcia, who's been living in Massachusetts after fleeing her native Guatemala. In a separate case, a judge in Chicago today ruled that federal officials must reunite a 10-year-old Brazilian boy with his mother. She lives in Boston. He's been detained for the past 6 weeks. In Chicago. Federal ocean managers are extending a right whale protected area until the middle of the month. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is asking mariners to avoid the protected area south of Nantucket or reduce speeds if they have to travel through it. The population of right whales is estimated at about 450 animals. Our weather forecast is calling for a few clouds tonight with lows in the 70s. Showers tomorrow, thunderstorms as well, highs in the 80s. And Saturday, sunny, a break in the humidity, highs in the 70s.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Tower Hill Botanic Garden with local food and area brews at Free Thursdays evenings in the Beer Garden this July and August. More at towerhillbg.org. And the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The embattled administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency is out. President Trump says he's accepted Scott Pruitt's resignation. This comes after months of ethical scandals. Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, will take over the agency in an acting capacity on Monday. And now to talk about these latest developments, we are joined by NPR's Scott Horsley, who's at the White House. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you, Elsa.
So the president broke this news on Twitter this afternoon. How exactly did he word this announcement?
He put out a pair of tweets saying he has accepted Pruitt's resignation and that he will always be thankful for Pruitt's service at the EPA. As you mentioned, he has tapped Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, who is a former coal lobbyist, to take over the agency in an acting capacity next week. And Trump added, "We have made tremendous progress, and the future of the EPA is bright." Now, under this administration, the EPA has been steadily rolling back environmental regulations, weakening efforts to address climate change. Pruitt, like the president, was skeptical about the overwhelming scientific consensus that climate change is occurring and that human activity, namely greenhouse gases, is a major contributor.
Right. Pruitt was also and has been under investigation for months for various ethical lapses, the sort of thing that took down other cabinet secretaries much more quickly. Pruitt denied these allegations. Here's what he told Congress back in April.
Facts are facts and fiction is fiction. And a lie doesn't become truth just because it appears on the front page of the newspaper. Much of what has been targeted towards me and my team has been half-truths or, at best, stories that have been so twisted they do not resemble reality.
So how did Pruitt survive as long as he did?
Well, because he was aggressively carrying out the president's deregulatory agenda. Scott Pruitt was tailor-made to carry out that agenda of unwinding Obama-era policies. He had fought aggressively against those policies in his old job as attorney general in the fossil fuel-rich state of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
When Trump announced he was pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords last year, it was Scott Pruitt who was at his side in the Rose Garden. And then Pruitt later dined out at a swanky French restaurant here in Washington. So, you know, for a long time, Trump was willing to overlook the mounting ethical scandals, whether it was the sweetheart housing deal in a condo owned by the wife of a lobbyist, or Pruitt's lavish spending on air travel, his 24-hour security detail that accompanied him to the Rose Bowl and other events. You know, for months now, the White House had said those things were troubling, but they liked what Pruitt was doing at the EPA. And as late as this afternoon, the president was tweeting that within the agency, Pruitt had done an outstanding job.
So after all that support from the White House, what finally forced Pruitt to step aside today?
You know, I'm not sure what was the last straw, but in recent weeks, we have been seeing testimony coming out from EPA officials about how Pruitt used agency staffers to carry out personal favors, including trying to land a lucrative job for his wife. And these accounts weren't coming from, you know, career EPA officials, the sort of deep state critics who were horrified at his deregulatory agenda. These were coming from political appointees who shared that agenda.
What does Pruitt's departure mean for the overall direction of the EPA going forward now?
It probably doesn't mean much change. In his tweet this afternoon, the president said, "I have no doubt that Andy Wheeler will continue on with our great and lasting EPA agenda." Now, Wheeler is more of a Washington insider than Pruitt was. He is probably savvy enough to sort of fly a little more below the radar. He won't be quite so in your face, and he probably won't try to use agency resources to carry, you know, line his own pockets. But he has been a coal lobbyist. So when it comes to the climate agenda, he will be very much on the same page as Scott Pruitt and the same page as President Trump.
All right. That's NPR's Scott Horsley at the White House. Thank you very much, Scott.
Good to be with you.
All right, to another story now, immigration. Since the implementation of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, migrants crossing the southwest border have dropped by 18%.
And today, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said the government will comply with a court order to reunite immigrant children with their parents.
That's right. The government faces a deadline next Tuesday to reunite children under the age of five with parents who are in custody. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has been following the status of those children.
Well, according to Secretary Azar, overall, there are 11,800 minors in the care of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
80% of those are teenagers, mostly males, who cross the border on their own. He also said that his agency has identified under 3,000 children who may have been separated from their purported parents, and those parents are in the custody of Homeland Security. Of those 3,000 minors, about 100 are under the age of five, and they are in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Azar said his agency has undertaken a manual review of all the case files and all the information shared by Homeland Security about who the parents are.
Bring us up to speed on what deadlines exactly the administration is facing to get these children back with their parents.
Well, on June 26th, a federal judge in San Diego ruled that the administration has to reunite children with parents. And for children under the age of five, the deadline is next Tuesday. For children between the ages of 5 through 17, the deadline is July 26. Azar stressed what he called an all-hands-on-deck effort to verify parentage, go through all the files, and make sure that the child was separated by the government. It's important to keep in mind that some of these children were in the care of HHS even before the administration announced its zero-tolerance policy.
So some of these kids have been in custody for months.
That's correct.
Okay.
And because of the time constraints put on them by the court, and these time constraints Azar repeatedly characterized as extreme and artificial, they are doing DNA testing on the kids to confirm their biological parents.
So, Richard, what about this central question of whether the government will be able to meet the deadline, which is coming up very fast next Tuesday, for reuniting the youngest kids with their parents?
Right. Azar said they will comply with that court order. He said that they're moving parents in ICE custody to facilities that are closer to the children that they have identified. They have not moved kids in with parents yet, but they will do everything they can to comply with the court order.
With respect to the court's order of reunifying children in our care with parents who remain in ICE custody, that is a novel proposition because we've got a court order that requires at DHS after 20 days that you separate children from families in ICE custody and send them to us. We now have a more recent court order requiring that we send those kids back to DHS in ICE custody indefinitely. Now, of course, our position is that that more recent order trumps the previous order.
I'm listening to that, Richard, and I'm still confused over what exactly the government plan is for going forward here.
It is confusing. In essence, what he's describing is setting up the scenario for another legal battle. Under the Flores settlement, children can't be detained for more than 20 days. But the Justice Department has petitioned in a separate court case that the government should be allowed to hold children with their parents indefinitely. That sets up a friction that has to be taken care of.
All right. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you.
The Trump administration announced today that it will extend temporary protected status for immigrants from Yemen. The Department of Homeland Security previously said that it would end TPS for people from several other countries around the world, including Haiti and El Salvador. But the administration chose a different course for Yemen, which is embroiled in a brutal civil war. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
The decision to extend TPS means more than 1,200 Yemenis can continue to live and work in the U.S. legally for at least another 18 months. People like Mohammed Al-Amari. Al-Amari works behind the counter at a deli in Manhattan, a few blocks from Penn Station.
Lettuce, mayo, light mayo, just a little bit, black pepper.
Thank you.
Al-Amari says he works 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, to pay his rent in Brooklyn and support his family back home in Yemen.
You know, my kids, my wife, my mom, my brothers, I have to, you know, because there's the world over there. There's nobody working there. You know, that's the problem.
The civil war in Yemen has killed thousands and brought the country's economy to a standstill, and it's made it dangerous for people like Al-Amari to go back. That's why the Department of Homeland Security decided to extend TPS for Yemen. Immigrants with TPS are allowed to live and work legally in the U.S., but only temporarily. The Trump administration is terminating TPS for hundreds of thousands of immigrants from other countries, including Haiti, El Salvador, and Sudan. That raised concerns that they would do the same for Yemen. But today, former U.S. officials who've worked there are relieved.
This is an ongoing humanitarian catastrophe that may have been a factor in their decision.
Barbara Bodine is a former ambassador to Yemen under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. She now directs the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Bodine says TPS was originally granted for immigrants from Yemen in 2015 because of the civil war.
And in the intervening 3 years, the situation has only gotten worse. This is not a situation where it's turning the corner in a positive way. It has gone off a cliff in a bad way.
The number of Yemenis who already have TPS is not huge, roughly 1,250, according to the Department of Homeland Security. And the administration says it won't accept any new applicants for TPS unless they've been in the country since before 2017. The Yemeni American community has already been hit hard by the president's immigration policies. The travel ban has made it nearly impossible for Yemenis to bring family members to the U.S. Mohammed Al-Amari says his own brother is stuck in Yemen.
There's a lot of people like that. You know, somebody, they try to bring his kids. Somebody, they try his mom. It's not easy.
But Al-Amari says at least he knows he can stay in the U.S. through early 2020.
Nothing else. We're coming to work. It's a good country. Inside the country is the best country in the world.
If he didn't have TPS, Al-Amari says he doesn't know what he would do. But going back to Yemen is not an option. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And this is 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on All Things Considered, in a Virginia county where the coal industry was once thriving, jobs are now extremely scarce. In business news, the first company seeking a license to sell recreational marijuana in Worcester has submitted all of its paperwork to the state. Hedico LLC has applied to cultivate marijuana in Worcester. Of the 63 license applications that the state is reviewing, 16 are in Worcester County, the most of any Massachusetts county. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow was up 181 points to close at 24,356. The Nasdaq rose almost 84 points. Marketplace will have all the day's business news at 6:30. In our weather forecast, we should feel a break in the humidity starting in the morning, according to WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
It will feel over 90 right through 6 or 7 o'clock this evening, and then will slowly start to fall back as actual temperatures fall to the 70s overnight. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms, especially the first part of the day. Those could produce some heavy rain. I don't expect a lot of widespread severe weather, however. Mid-80s. Saturday, lots of sunshine, upper 70s, low humidity. Sunday, mid-80s with low humidity. Monday and Tuesday, temperatures in the mid to upper 80s, a few 90-degree readings are possible.
It is 93 degrees right now in Boston, 84 in Hyannis at 20 past 4.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Staples, with printers, printer ink, and toner cartridges for home and business, and in-store print shops for customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. In-store and online, Staples. And Wells Fargo, established 1852, re-established 2018 with a recommitment to customers, working off the principles the company was founded on. WellsFargo.com/renew. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump has promised to bring back coal, but the chances of a young person in central Appalachia getting a job in coal are still pretty slim. That's even though there has been a spike in the price of metallurgical coal, the kind that's used to make steel. That spike has resulted in a few more coal jobs. For the Embedded podcast, Kelly McEvers and Chris Benderev spent a year and a half following several young people in the region who, once they decided not to work in coal, faced some very hard choices. Here is the story of one of them.
When we went to Central Appalachia, we always stayed at this one hotel in Buchanan County, Virginia. And that's where we first meet Brad Pennington in late 2016. Brad works the front desk.
Yeah, well, I mean, the lobby looks like it's a part of the Golden Girls set, so yeah.
Brad's kind of darkly sarcastic, but thoughtful. He tells us how fun it was to grow up here, hunting and fishing and riding four-wheelers in the mountains. But, he says, being an adult here isn't easy.
When did you start to realize that fact?
You figure it out pretty quick. I applied for quite a few jobs senior year of high school, and only one I got was Walmart, and that was temp work through winter.
After Walmart, Brad tried community college, then dropped out. Worked in a scrapyard after that, and then for a little while as a security guard at a coal mine. But then a guy died in the mine, and Brad got spooked. And he heard layoffs were coming, so he quit. Brad's dad worked in coal, but he hurt his back doing it.
And he told me from the very beginning, just don't do it. Just go somewhere else. Do anything else.
So Brad got this hotel job. At this point, he works the night shift, makes $8 an hour. He lives at home with his parents. He's single. And most of his high school friends have left the county.
There's nothing here in Buchanan County. It's slowly dying.
How does that feel?
It scares the out of you, if you don't mind me saying that. I mean, it really does. I mean, if you got fired tomorrow or quit tomorrow, there's absolutely no opportunity to get another one. I mean, you're fighting 50 other people on a list a mile long to get a minimum wage job anymore. I mean, you get a job, you keep it, because you know you got to.
But even if there are more coal jobs now in his hometown, Brad thinks that this upturn in metallurgical coal is just a blip in the boom and bust cycle. He doesn't agree with his friends and relatives who think that coal is going to make some big comeback.
It is a dying industry, and you can't keep propping it up and hoping for it to last forever, because it won't. And they know that, but they don't care. They just want it to work right here, right now, so they can live happy and have their money and whatever. And they would rather save 50 jobs for 5 years versus create 500 jobs in 10 years. You know, there are just a lot of hard-headed people around here that here we're going to bring back coal and they're all for it.
So Brad thinks that at this point, the best thing that he can do is to leave. This job, this county, the whole thing.
And eventually, he does leave. He gets a better-paying job delivering Pepsi to gas stations and grocery stores, and he gets an apartment about an hour away. He calls and texts to tell us how he's doing. But then, a year after we first meet him, this past spring, we go back to the hotel and we're surprised. Standing there, again, at the front desk, wearing the same corporate light blue polo shirt he was wearing when we met him, is Brad. He's not looking happy.
So what happened at Pepsi? Like, what happened?
My direct supervisor...
Brad says he and his boss did not get along. Boss would criticize little mistakes, things Brad didn't think should be a big deal, but...
With me, it was a fireable offense, you know.
Finally, Brad's boss called him into the office and told him that he was fired. And Brad panicked. Because he still had to pay rent and heat and water and gas and cable and internet and food for the kitten that he just adopted with his girlfriend. He needed a job. Immediately. So after getting fired, he called up the hotel And even though it is a place that he does not want to work, he asked for his job back.
I got fired on a Tuesday, and by Tuesday night I was working here. I'd go to Walmart and work if I knew I could pull enough hours to cover my bills, but that's the problem with Walmart. There's no guarantee you're going to pull 20 hours, let alone 36 hours. I'm not going to work under that uncertainty. I got too many bills to pay.
And did you have to take a pay cut to come back here?
Oh, big time. I make less now than I did when I quit, because I quit and come back.
Brad is making less than he was when we first met him a year ago, and he's doing the same job. His girlfriend, who works at a supermarket, pays for groceries.
Because I can never afford it, you know. I'm tapped out paying the rent and my truck payments. And then I buy gas for both our cars.
So so you can cover all that stuff, like you said.
But it's the skid of our teeth, basically. Okay. I mean, it's getting tough.
Really?
To this point, yeah.
Have there been times recently you've been really worried?
And yeah. A lot of times.
What does that feel like or sound like or look like? Or?
It's not fun. It's not fun.
I'm sorry.
I'm okay. I still don't like thinking about it. It just is. It's tough. I mean, I make less than $8 an hour here, so.
Less than.
And that kind of stuff just gets to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as I'm on, I was doing good. Which I still am, but not as good.
Over the next few months, Brad spends his time searching, and sometimes interviewing, for better jobs. Meter reader at the power company, cable guy. Those didn't work out. But then, this one did.
Thank you for calling. This is Brad. May I get the account number or the phone number you are contacting us about today?
It's at a call center, and it pays $10.25 an hour, which is more than the hotel.
Call center jobs are the kinds of jobs people in the area like to point to as a possible replacement for coal jobs. This job pays a lot less than coal. It's enough to get by, but it's not enough for Brad to move away, maybe go to college, and have a better life. For Embedded, I'm Kelly McEvers.
And I'm Chris Benderev.
A golden retriever named Sam has gone to his final reward without spilling the beans.
Sam played Duke, Jay Bush's crafty canine companion, in the ads for Bush's baked beans.
The running gag, Duke knows the secret to the company's recipe and claims he'll stay mum.
You can trust me, Jay.
I know, boy, but I'm not taking any chances.
Bush Brothers and Company confirmed Sam's death. He was just one of the several Goldens who played Duke over the years.
But why use a dog to sell beans? After all, many vets say baked beans aren't good for dogs.
Well, Jay Bush, that would be the great-grandson of the company's founder, really had a golden retriever named Duke. And in the mid-1990s, when Bush's baked beans needed a new advertising campaign, they decided to capitalize on Jay and Duke's relationship.
People love dogs. People love beans.
The real Duke, though, was not up to snuff, a little camera shy. Here's company marketing VP Jennifer Podaski.
We require our Dukes to be great actors, and we wanted to make sure family dogs could remain as family dogs.
So they called in the canine actors, including Sam.
Podaski says despite Sam's death, the tradition of Duke will live on.
Bush's secret family recipe for sale.
Duke! Duke!
Did you have something to do with this?
Right, Jay. I'm running a printing press in my basement.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station. Coming up, NPR's Nina Totenberg about the three people on President Trump's Supreme Court shortlist. Our weather forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Tomorrow, showers, thunderstorms, highs in the 80s. Sunshine on Saturday with temperatures only in the upper 70s. And for Sunday, it'll be sunny with highs in the 80s. It is 92 degrees right now in Boston at 4:30.
Funding for WBUR Weather Reports comes from Charles River Apparel, home of the original New Englander rain jacket since 1983. A wind and waterproof hooded rain jacket for all-around use, available in 20 color combinations, including blue and white striped, gray, aqua, red, and navy. Learn more and locate a Charles River Apparel retailer at charlesriverapparel.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. President Trump narrows his field of possible Supreme Court nominees, prepares for a summit with Vladimir Putin, and writes a letter to NATO allies demanding they pay more for defense ahead of next week's big meeting in Brussels. We'll discuss with our weekly Politics Roundtable.
Tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Scott Pruitt has resigned as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The news came a short time ago by presidential tweet. The president said Pruitt has done an outstanding job, but he has accepted his resignation. Deputy Administrator Andrew Wheeler will assume leadership of the agency Monday. Pruitt is the subject of several ethics investigations. Firefighters are battling several major wildfires in the western U.S., including two in Utah. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Judy Fays reports.
More than 1,000 people are fighting wildfires in opposite corners of Utah. Together, the fires have burned more than 84 square miles. The biggest is the Dollar Ridge fire in Deschene County in the northeast. Fire officials say hundreds of people have been evacuated. Spokesman Don Jack works for the National Forest Service. He says the Dollar Ridge fire is spreading fast.
As embers are taken up into the atmosphere, they've been deposited up to over a half a mile away from where the fire was located.
The West Valley fire in the southwestern part of the state has grown to nearly 19 square miles. For NPR News, I'm Judy Fays in Salt Lake City.
Two people remain critically ill in England after being exposed to the same Cold War-era nerve agent that sickened a former Russian agent and his daughter in England in March. Officials say they apparently came in contact with a contaminated item. But Debbie Stark with Public Health England says the risk to the general public remains low.
Obviously, I completely understand why people would be anxious. But I would like to remind you that we're working on the best information we have. We haven't had any other members of the public that have presented with symptoms.
Officials are urging anyone who's been in the area to launder their clothes and wipe down their personal items, such as phones and laptops. Stocks closed higher today. The Dow is up 181 points. The S&P gained 23. This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker in Boston. Massachusetts lawmakers are weighing in on the resignation of federal EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. In a tweet, Senator Ed Markey says it's, quote, about damn time. Senator Elizabeth Warren said Pruitt should have, quote, resigned 28 scandals ago. And Congressman Jim McGovern says Pruitt never should have been appointed in the first place. Attorneys for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev want access to recordings of an FBI interview with a man who was killed while he was being questioned. Authorities say Ibrahim Todashev confessed that he and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were responsible for a triple murder in Waltham in 2011. The FBI was interviewing Todashev as part of its investigation into the marathon bombings. An FBI agent said that he shot and killed Todashev because Todashev charged at agents who were questioning him. The attorneys for Zahar Tsarnaev have not said why they want those documents for their appeal of Tsarnaev's death sentence. Harvard University's recently retired president is now on the Goldman Sachs board of directors. Drew Faust joins the investment banking company after overseeing Harvard for 11 years. Larry Bacow replaced Faust earlier this week. Tufts Health Plan says it will be the first insurer in Massachusetts to share drug rebates directly with its members. The president of commercial products, Mark Bacon, says the savings could be substantial, perhaps $100 for a $500 arthritis medicine. He also says it will help patients avoid taking steps on their own to try to keep costs down.
Some of them split their drugs or they take them every other day, and that doesn't have the outcome that obviously we want to achieve. So this is another way to help people have access to the drugs they need.
The discounts will be limited to members with high deductible plans. University of New Hampshire researchers are trying to improve wild bee habitats. They're looking at which wildflowers best sustain pollination. Researcher Kathy Neal says bees are important to various species.
Not all plants need bee pollination, but many plants do need pollination by some kind of insect or animal in order to complete the life cycle. So it's really important that bees remain in that ecology.
Neal hopes that meadows will be filled with a variety of wildflower species that will bloom from May through October. Our weather forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight. Temperatures in the 70s. Showers tomorrow. Highs in the 80s. Saturday, sunshine. Temperatures in the 70s. And Sunday will be sunny with highs in the 80s. It is 91 degrees right now in Boston at 435.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit composed of financial services organizations working to educate Americans about options for securing protected lifetime income in retirement. More at AllianceForLifetimeIncome.org. And Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. President Trump has whittled down his shortlist of Supreme Court nominees to fill the seat that's going to be vacated by Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's expected to announce his final pick next Monday. To learn more about the people on that list, we're joined by NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hey, Nina.
Hi there.
So I know you've been doing a lot of reporting into who is on this list. What can you tell us now?
So it looks to me from my reporting as if the final two, maybe three, are Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who's 53 years old and who serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and has a lengthy record. Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who was appointed by President Trump to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and has been on that court for, I think, a year or less. And she very much has the support of religious conservatives, but she has a relatively tiny record. And third, Raymond Ketledge of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, another Republican judge with a sort of a record of a number of years.
All right. So, and then there were three. Let's dig into some of these names. Let's go ahead and start with Brett Kavanaugh. Can you tell us a little more about him, his jurisprudence?
Well, he actually clerked on the Supreme Court for the man he would replace, Anthony Kennedy. He was named to the D.C. Circuit by George W. Bush in 2003, but his confirmation was stalled by Democrats for nearly 3 years.
Wow.
Because they said he was too partisan, too young, and too inexperienced. He was eventually confirmed and, as I said, has had a distinguished record, very conservative record on the D.C. Circuit, but often doesn't go quite as far as some conservatives would like.
Okay, so that is Brett Kavanaugh. What can you tell us about Amy Barrett?
Well, Amy Barrett has a long written record as a professor at Notre Dame Law School. She is loved by the social conservative wing of the party. And at her confirmation hearing, her nomination became a lightning rod for everybody. Senator Dianne Feinstein said to her, "Look, if you're on this list of potential Supreme Court nominees, I think you're there, it's obvious, because you would overturn Roe versus Wade." And this is what Amy Barrett said in response to that.
"I'm being considered for a position on a court of appeals, and there would be no opportunity to be a no vote on Roe. And as I said to the committee, I would faithfully apply all Supreme Court precedent."
Of course, there is no, if you're on the Supreme Court, you don't have to apply precedent. that's not what you're supposed to do. You determine it. You're capable of overturning it. But Feinstein also said something that really got particularly Catholics infuriated. And here's what she said.
"When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you."
Now, that word dogma
means
you're unmovable. And it suggested to many that Judge Barrett would not be able to rule against her private desires, her private religious beliefs. And the word dogma, the whole statement has become something of a joyous refrain among conservatives. There are T-shirts that say, "The dogma lives within me."
Okay.
Right.
So it sounds like Kavanaugh and Barrett represent sort of a divide within the Republican Party between social conservatives and maybe more establishment Republicans. How would you describe this divide, this fight that's going on between those two potential nominees?
I would describe this as a reflection of the Republican Party. I'm not sure that there's a dime's worth of difference between Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Barrett, but their supporters, particularly the supporters of social conservatives, they just think she's one of them and that he's somehow a Washington insider. One of the people I know who knows both Kavanaugh and Barrett and loves them both and is very conflicted said, I said, how do you explain this internal war that seems to be going on? He said, it's a color war. You know, you get assigned a color in camp and it's a color war.
Well, if they can't decide between those two, it sounds like the last name, at least on this short list, is Raymond Kethledge. He's on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, as you mentioned. He's from Michigan.
And he is the only non-Catholic on this short list of six or eight people that the president, by and large, has talked to in person. He's an evangelical. I would say that his written record is not as extensive. But my sense today was that even though that a lot of the people who are pushing for Judge Barrett will really be perfectly happy to vote for Judge Kavanaugh. The only question is whether out there in the hinterlands, this can get to be a battle cry of some kind. And I'm not sure that there's enough time for that to happen.
All right. That's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
Claude Lanzmann shocked the world in 1985 with his 9.5-hour documentary film, Shoah. It told the story of the Holocaust through the voices of those who experienced it. Lanzmann was part of the French Resistance as a teenager during World War II. He went on to study philosophy. He was mentored by Jean-Paul Sartre, and he was Simone de Beauvoir's longtime lover. Claude Lanzmann died in Paris today. He was 92. NPR's Ted Robbins has this appreciation.
In the opening scene of Shoah, a Hebrew word meaning catastrophe that's become a synonym for the Holocaust, Simon Shrebnik sings as he rows a boat on a river near Chelmo, Poland. This 47-year-old man is returning to the place where 400,000 Polish Jews were gassed by the Nazis. In the film, only stone foundations remain in a green field. When he was 13, Shrebnik was put to work by the Nazis, collecting the remains of his fellow Jews and dumping their ashes in the river. It was Claude Lanzmann's idea, innovative at the time, to tell the story of the Holocaust not through narration and newsreel footage, but solely through interviews with survivors, ex-Nazis, even a man who drove a train carrying Jews to the death camps.
This film kills the distance between the past and the present.
Lanzmann spoke with NPR in 1985 when Shoah was released.
It is a kind of big question that everybody is asking. Why? Why did this happen? But there is no answer to the why. And I think that the only way to answer the why is to go in the most extreme details of the how.
Shoah won awards and was called a masterpiece. It was not well received in Poland, where the government objected that it showed the Polish people's complicity with the Nazis. Lanzmann interviewed Jan Karski, a Polish resistance fighter, who was approached by Jewish leaders to tell the rest of the world about the genocide. He had a hard time believing it.
I was not prepared for it. I was relatively isolated in my work in Poland. I did not see many things.
Karski had a hard time convincing the rest of the world. Patricia Ofterheide is a professor at American University and a former editor of American Film Magazine. She says the movie does show the past is also the present.
One of the more shocking things about Shoah is the interviews with people in the Polish villages who are quite comfortable with inhabiting the homes of Jews who died and who continue to express anti-Semitic sentiments.
Earlier this year, the Polish government enacted a law making it illegal to accuse the nation of complicity in the Holocaust. Keeping memory alive in the face of Holocaust deniers was one reason Claude Lanzmann made his films. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
2 weeks ago, the city of Philadelphia had two public pools that maintained this policy from another era. There were days when only men and boys could swim and days when only women, girls, and young children could swim. But the practice of gender-segregated swimming ended this Monday. That came just days after a tweet to the city's Parks and Rec Department questioning the policy. Michaela Winberg reported the story for the local news website Billy Penn, and she joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Michaela, hey there. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. So what's the history? Why did these same gendered swim times come to be in the first place in Philadelphia?
Back in the 1880s, public pools were originally designed to be just sort of public baths for people who could not afford bathrooms in their own homes, that sort of thing. So they instituted these public baths, and naturally they had separate days for men and boys and for women and girls. And that sort of lasted even as the popularity of public pools grew beyond just that class of people.
Let me fast forward us up to 2001, when a lot of the swimming pools in Philadelphia that had been gender segregated had a policy change. What happened in 2001? Why did they change?
So at that point, the Philadelphia Daily News reported that a mother in South Philadelphia, she was at Barry Playground, and she took her 7-month-old son into the pool on a girl's day, and she sort of got in trouble for it. She got kicked out.
Her 7-month-old son, and she got
right,
in trouble.
Right, an
wow,
infant.
All right.
And at the time, the city councilman, Jim Kenney, who's now the Philadelphia mayor, recommended that Parks and Rec, you know, consider changing it. And so at that time, they did change the policy. They rolled back what they called single-sex swimming schedules at most of the pools. There are about 70 public pools in Philly, and they rolled it back at most of those public pools. But there were a couple that sort of lingered.
All right. So this brings us up to last week.
Mm-hmm.
And a conversation that played out on Twitter, a Twitter thread mm-hmm. directed at the city's Parks and Rec Department. A woman named Dina Driscoll on June 26th, we've dug it out, June 26th, 3:42 p.m., she wrote, "Can you explain your gendered pool rules to me? Why do some of your pools gender on certain days?" And Michaela, walk us through what happened after that, tweet went out.
It seems to me like a few people responded to her. Some people said, "Oh, yeah, that's been a long tradition in Philly. I remember that from when I was a kid." Or some people were like, "Wait, that is really weird. Like, why is that still a thing?" And a little less than 24 hours later, Parks and Rec, the department Twitter, actually responded and said, basically, it's over. Like, you're right. You got a point there. And they said, effective July 2nd, which was this most recent Monday, that would no longer be a policy at any pools in the city. So they canceled it at those two remaining pools.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this is a conversation playing out on Twitter and at public pools in 2018. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether any transgendered people or people who don't identify with a specific gender had weighed in on this debate at all.
Not that I had seen on Twitter, but the Twitter user who called this out, Dina, she asked that exact question. She was like, how does this impact people who are transgender, people who don't identify with a gender? What would the policy be for them? And I think that had to be part of the reason that the whole thing was called off. It just wasn't really fair.
That is reporter Michaela Winberg with Billy Penn talking there about the updated swimming pool policy in Philadelphia. Michaela, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And we reached out to Philadelphia Parks and Recreation and the two public pools to find out how the new policy is working. We heard back from the Murphy Recreation Center. They confirm they are no longer implementing gender-segregated swim days. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5 Insurance Services. Insurance know-how for the business you're building. Salem5.com/insurance lets uncomplicate your coverage. And College Vine. Mentors selected from Yale, UCLA, Rice, and more help with SAT scores through tutoring and test prep. CollegeVine.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on All Things Considered, the peculiar history of celebrity perfumes. Our weather forecast is calling for some clouds tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Showers tomorrow. We could see some flash flooding along the coast tomorrow. Highs will be in the 80s and sunshine on Saturday with temperatures only in the upper 70s. Still 91 degrees in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by East Meets West Catering. More than 25 years of culinary and event experience, specializing in a personalized approach for every palate. EMWCatering.com. And Nuance Healthcare, delivering AI-powered speech recognition services for clinical documentation and decision support, multiplying the everyday impact on the patient and physician experience. Learn more at Nuance.com. Nuance, the power of you, multiplied.
The Trump administration's tariffs on foreign steel are supposed to help the steel industry here in the U.S., but they could backfire.
So the U.S. companies, they're allowed to raise their prices to be in that same ballpark. So if the price is up for steel coming in, the price will go up here in the U.S.
And that could hit steel sales and steel jobs. The unintended consequences of steel tariffs, tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In 1991, Elizabeth Taylor did something really special. Not on camera, but in retail. She released a perfume called White Diamonds.
White Diamonds, the intriguing fragrance from Elizabeth Taylor.
Taylor was not the first celebrity to do this, but she was the first truly successful one. White Diamonds continues to be one of the best-selling celebrity fragrances in the world to this day. Who knew? Celebrity fragrances have multiplied and flopped over the years, but now they're making an unexpected comeback. Here to tell us about this is Jenna Rosenstein, senior beauty editor for HarpersBazaar.com. Hey there.
Hi.
So what did White Diamonds smell like? What kind of women was Elizabeth Taylor trying to sell to?
Elizabeth Taylor was trying to sell to women like her who wanted to have a lifestyle like her. So it was a very elegant fragrance, but elegant in a way that fragrances were in the early 90s. It was a scent for older women.
So something more floral, less fruity is what I'm imagining.
Exactly. Elizabeth Taylor's fragrance was definitely floral. However, younger consumers have always been drawn to fruity, juicy, candy-like scents. And it's
like
true.
Bubblegum.
They love candy. And so you can see that there is definitely a discrepancy there between, you know, what somebody older might want to wear and what the younger generation was looking for and are still looking for today.
Okay. But then the next big celebrity fragrance after Elizabeth Taylor didn't come from an actress. It came from a singer.
Do you dare?
Okay, I'll let you do the honors here. Who is this alluring voice?
That is none other than Miss Britney Spears.
And what was so captivating about this particular scent? It just skyrocketed.
It did. So her first perfume came out in 2004, and she has two that really, really took off out of her portfolio of 23 fragrances.
23?
23. She has 23 fragrances, and she has been massively successful. Her first fragrance, Curious, followed up by the second fragrance, Fantasy, have done hundreds and millions of dollars in profits over the years. And it was just Britney Spears' first fragrance totally changed the industry for years to come.
What was her magic formula?
Nobody else was talking to young women in the fragrance market. Nobody was really making something for young girls. And she captured the essence of sort of the fun, fruity body splashes you could get at the mall, but packaged it in this beautiful, colorful bottle that you wanted to keep on your vanity.
So then the weird thing was that after Britney Spears had this incredible success, other celebrities tried to replicate what she did, and it didn't go too well. What happened?
Well, there were so many celebrity fragrances that came after Britney Spears, and a lot of them were successful. I mean, even Rihanna, Selena Gomez, Taylor Swift. It seemed like if you were a celebrity, you had to have a fragrance.
Was the market just too saturated for any one fragrance to stand out?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. It came to a point where every single person was releasing a scent. And I think also consumer tastes were changing. They were craving authenticity. Social media was really taking off. Uh-huh. And they knew that these celebrities weren't really behind the scents. They knew that the One Direction band members were probably not in the lab working with the noses on their scent.
Okay, and then in 2017, we see another shift. Reality TV star Kim Kardashian West jumped on this bandwagon and release her own perfume, and it caught fire. Why would Kim Kardashian be able to sell perfume better than, say, all those other celebrities you just listed?
Well, Kim Kardashian approached perfume in 2017 in a completely different way. And you could tell that she had a hand in every single element of that perfume.
How do you show that as a celebrity?
It starts, I think, at the bottle. Consumers today are not as interested even in what it smells like. As long as it's an unoffensive scent, they're down. Like, they will buy it. But it's really all about the bottle in the age of Instagram. And so Kim Kardashian quite literally copied her body. So she is in it and deeply involved.
So all these women are clicking buy on this perfume and they don't even know what it smells like.
Nope, they have never smelled it. They're not available in department stores. She is selling direct to her consumers, and they are buying it. And then afterwards, they can decide whether or not they like it. But at least they could take a picture and post it on social media saying, I had one of the Kim Kardashian fragrances.
Have men been attempting to break into this field?
David Beckham has a line of fragrances. Jay-Z has had a fragrance. Pitbull has had a fragrance. But the problem is that they haven't struck any longevity in the industry. But I do think there's opportunity here, but nobody has done it yet. I do think in the age of streetwear brands, I think a Yeezy fragrance from Kanye West could do spectacularly well. But something I think a lot of streetwear brands could do, they just haven't done it yet.
Jenna Rosenstein is the senior beauty editor for HarpersBazaar.com. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
At the end of the Marvel movie Avengers Infinity War, there were a lot of unanswered questions. Now, the question, where was Ant-Man? That was maybe not the most urgent question, but our critic Bob Mondello says the answer to that question does figure in the new movie Ant-Man and the Wasp, sort of.
Did we know that Ant-Man was under house arrest?
Can I just wait inside? Because I'm not supposed to be out here.
For the last 2 years, apparently. I'm not going to pretend I remember the original Ant-Man movie all that well. What I do remember is that it was pretty funny and that Paul Rudd's Scott Lang made a nice kind of unassuming change from the broad-shouldered superheroes elsewhere.
I seem to mess it up almost every time.
Super confidence, not his strong suit, but give him a good enough reason and he'll shrink to the occasion. What gets him going this time is multiple bad guys, or gals, and a mission to head for the quantum realm, which is subatomic, and, well, there's a lot of plot, virtually unspoilable because it makes so little sense, so why don't we let Ant-Man's pal Luis handle it?
You opened up the quantum realm. That's when this crazy creepy ghost who, like, walks through walls and stuff, stole your tech. And now she wants to take over the world or whatever.
That's pretty much it, which means the first half hour is really slow as they're laying everything out, and digressing, which, when this movie isn't shrinking things to ant size, is pretty much what it does.
Help yourself.
Hey, what's up with the fancy pastry? We gotta keep the food budget down.
Well, what are we supposed to have for breakfast?
The oatmeal packets.
Oatmeal packets.
It's insult. Why is it an insult?
Because it tastes like sin.
Put some cinnamon, put a little honey,
you,
whatever.
Guys, come on, man. We got bigger fish to fry.
Is that my desk?
Yeah. Why do I have such a small desk?
Well, because you weren't there when we were choosing desks.
There are also fights and chases involving micro cars, macro Pez dispensers, and since Ant-Man, unlike the Wasp, is wingless and has to call in flying ants when he wants a ride, hungry seagulls.
Oh, sorry. Oh, sorry. Hey, not cool. Come on, man. One time, please. Yes! I'm gonna call you Antonio Banderas.
Alas, another seagull.
No. Antonio!
Paul Rudd's amusing, especially when he gets to channel his inner Michelle Pfeiffer, and Evangeline Lilly's exasperated wasp is easily his equal.
You go low, I'll go high.
I have wings. Why would I go low?
The others are mostly smarter than the jokes they're asked to sell. Director Peyton Reed and his army of screenwriters haven't made Ant-Man and the Wasp a terribly clever movie, but it's clever enough to keep you from reaching for bug spray, and in the summer, Marvel has apparently decided that's all that's required. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from the New York Times, where journalists are currently reporting from more than 150 countries around the world to deliver coverage of the issues at stake. From foreign policy to the Second Amendment, The Times reports the story. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working alongside others to build a culture of health that provides everyone in America a fair and just opportunity for health and well-being. More at rwjf.org. And NEON, presenting Three Identical Strangers, a film about triplets separated at birth and the conspiracy that kept them apart. Three identical strangers now playing in L.A. and New York, opening in additional select markets tomorrow.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Our forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Tomorrow, showers, thunderstorms, flash flooding possible. Temperatures in the 80s. For Saturday, sunny. Highs only in the 70s. And Sunday, we should see sunshine. Temperatures in the 80s. Sunny with highs in the upper 80s for Monday. It is 91 degrees in Boston at 5 o'clock. From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom. 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. President Trump says he's accepted the resignation of scandal-plagued Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt. It's Thursday, July 5th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker. Coming up, a look at Scott Pruitt's history with the EPA. Also, Virginia becomes the second U.S. state to require mental health education in schools.
They need to know the basics about how mental illness affects a person, what the warning signs are, what to look for in their peers and themselves.
And the U.S. is expected to impose tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports, but one economist says most of the companies affected are not Chinese. It's 5:01. First, we'll take a look at this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Much maligned Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has announced he is stepping down. NPR's Scott Detrow has more.
Over the past few months, Pruitt has faced scandal after scandal, from reports he authorized excessive spending for personal travel and security, to reports he rented a room from a lobbyist at a below-market rate, to reports he used his official position to try and land his wife a job, among others. Throughout it all, President Trump stuck by his administrator. But now Trump says he's accepted Pruitt's resignation. During his time on the job, the former Oklahoma attorney general started the process of unraveling scores of Obama-era environmental protections. Chief among them, the federal government's main plan to lower national carbon dioxide emissions by shifting the energy sector away from coal. Scott Detrow, NPR News.
Deputy EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler will take over as acting administrator effective Monday. The Trump administration says it will extend temporary protections for immigrants from Yemen because of the country's brutal civil war. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, the Department of Homeland Security announced the 18-month extension Thursday.
The decision means that roughly 1,250 Yemenis can continue to live and work legally in the U.S. until at least March of 2020. The Trump administration has shown great skepticism about temporary protected status, or TPS. It's already announced the end of TPS for hundreds of thousands of immigrants from other countries, including El Salvador and Haiti. That led immigrant advocates to worry the administration would do the same for Yemen. But the Department of Homeland Security says it will extend TPS for Yemen because of the civil war that's killed thousands and brought the country's economy to a standstill. However, the administration will not accept any new applicants from Yemen unless they've been in the U.S. since before 2017. Joel Rose, NPR News.
Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says the government will meet court deadlines to reunite migrant children with their parents. He also noted many of those reunited families will remain in the custody of immigration authorities. Azar telling reporters today the government has been keeping tabs on the more than 2,000 children who were separated from their parents at the border.
We do know, and I want to be very clear about this, where every child is, and we know each is being well taken care of.
Federal judges ordered the children under the age of 5 be reunited with their parents by Tuesday, the rest by month's end. Azar says DNA testing is being used to speed up the process. Strong private sector jobs numbers for June are generating optimism that when the government releases its more inclusive employment report tomorrow, it will show similar gains. Payroll processor ADP says the figures show private employers added 177,000 jobs in June. A tech sector rally helped to boost Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 181 points. The NASDAQ rose 83 points. The S&P 500 was up 23. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker in Boston. Lawyers for the convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev want to review recordings of interviews with a man who was shot and killed by an FBI agent 5 years ago. More details now from WBUR's Mark Degan.
The recordings are of Ibrahim Tadashev allegedly confessing to three murders in Waltham committed along with Zahar Tsarnaev's older brother Tamerlan back in 2011. But Tsarnaev's lawyers don't know exactly what was said, as a judge has sealed those documents. Tadashev was killed by an FBI agent in the minutes after the interview in Florida with authorities who were investigating the Marathon bombings. They say he attacked them. Lawyers for Zahar Tsarnaev say in a motion that they'll formally request access to the material in the next 2 weeks. They are not saying how the material might help in their appeal of Tsarnaev's death sentence. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Mark Degan.
An 8-year-old Guatemalan girl has been reunited with her mother at Logan Airport nearly 2 months after federal authorities separated them shortly after they crossed the U.S.-Mexico border. A federal judge ordered the reunification of Angelica Gonzalez-Garcia and her 8-year-old daughter, who had been at a shelter in Texas. Angelica Gonzalez-Garcia has been staying with friends in Massachusetts during the attempt to be reunited with her daughter. The U.S. State Department is citing the courage of two Saudi students who drowned while trying to rescue children in Massachusetts. 27-year-old Thieb Al-Yami and 25-year-old Yasser Al-Raqqa drowned in the Chicopee River last week. The children are safe. Al-Raqqa was studying at Western New England University in Springfield, and Al-Yami was a student at the University of Hartford. Women in New Hampshire will soon be able to fill a full year's supply of birth control pills at one time. New Hampshire's governor signed into law a bill that would give women a full year's supply with one prescription. The measure also requires insurers to provide birth control without copays. Quinsigamond Community College in Worcester will open its first food pantry for students next week. A study by the school shows that 59% of its students went hungry at least once in a 30-day period. Terry Vecchio is the dean of students.
I think it's high, and I also think it's something that we have not really paid attention to in higher ed as a whole. And if you talk to my peers at the private institutions in Worcester, which I have, they too are dealing with food insecurity.
Worcester State University is also working to open a food pantry next year. Our weather forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Tomorrow, showers, thunderstorms, some flash flooding possible, highs in the 80s. And for Saturday, sunny with temperatures in the upper 70s. It is 91 degrees right now in Boston.
WBUR supporters include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Boundaries, a new comedy starring Christopher Plummer and Vera Farmiga about a daughter who takes an unexpected road trip with her estranged pot-dealing father, now playing.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Scott Pruitt is out as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. True to form, President Trump announced the news this afternoon with a tweet. This follows months of speculation and a growing list of alleged ethical lapses. NPR's Nathan Rott joins us to talk through what happened and what this means for the EPA going forward. Hi, Nate.
Hey.
So the president and the White House had been largely supportive of Pruitt up until now. What happened? Why the resignation now?
Well, that's true. I mean, even in announcing the resignation, Trump made a point to praise Pruitt for the, quote, outstanding job, unquote, he's done at the agency.
Mm-hmm.
But we should say, you know, the White House, Congress, government watchdogs had all been investigating this long, you know, seemingly ever-growing list of alleged ethical lapses by the administrator. And Pruitt, in his resignation letter to the president, said those, quote, unrelenting attacks on me personally, my family, are unprecedented and have taken a sizable toll on all of us.
And by attacks, I'm assuming he means that list of scandals. Can you walk us through all the scandals that have plagued his tenure?
I don't think we have time. It's a little hard to find a place to start, honestly. There are questions about Pruitt's close ties to industries before he was even confirmed as EPA's administrator, and that it seems that followed him to D.C. At EPA, Pruitt was accused of taking a sweetheart housing deal near Capitol Hill, where he rented from a lobbyist who had business before his agency. Here he is defending that in an interview on Fox last spring.
when you look at the issue and the facts, which most people don't, but when you look at the facts of what I leased and what I paid for, it is absolutely 100% ethical, and it was signed off and is legal.
Still, that episode is being investigated by the agency's inspector general in Congress. Pruitt was also criticized for taking expensive first-class flights, for misspending taxpayer money on a 24-hour security detail and a $43,000 soundproof phone booth.
I remember that one. Yep.
Yep. He allegedly hid meetings with industry heads, tried to circumvent public records laws, and asked staffers to do personal work for him, including trying to get his wife a job on their taxpayer-paid time.
All right, well, let's turn now and talk a little bit about the legacy he'll be leaving behind at the EPA. How would you characterize that?
Well, from a policy perspective, I think that Scott Pruitt is going to be very happy with the legacy that he left behind. He started efforts to undo a number of environmental policies that Trump railed against during his campaign, changes that oil and gas companies in many conservative parts of the country, frankly, wanted to see. He decreased environmental enforcement, sped up environmental reviews, rolled back what he called overly burdensome regulations to address air and water pollution. But there is a huge caveat that we need to mention here, which is that a lot of these rollbacks that Pruitt started, this deregulatory agenda, is still very much in its infancy. Getting rid of environmental rules and regulations or replacing them, as he's looking to do in a few cases, is a very, very long process. So a lot of that legacy question is still very much in flux.
Well, what happens to those rollbacks now that he's gone? Do they continue on without him, or is there a question about that?
It's still very much the expectation that they will continue on. Andrew Wheeler, who Trump says is taking over the agency on Monday, is very much in line with Pruitt's deregulatory agenda. He spent much of his career calling for less regulatory oversight at the agency. He was an aide to Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, and he had other political roles. Most recently, he represented the interests of some of the largest fossil fuel companies in the U.S. as a lobbyist. And that experience on Capitol Hill with industry means, frankly, that Wheeler knows how the EPA and D.C. works, arguably better than Pruitt ever did. He knows the politics around the agency, the mechanics and all that. So I think everyone, including the president, is expecting him to continue down the path that Pruitt started, presumably without all of that unwanted baggage.
All right. That's NPR's Nate Rott. Thank you.
Thank you.
For some reaction to the Pruitt news today, let's bring in Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. He's a member of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. Senator Cardin, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
So what is your reaction to the news today that Scott Pruitt is out?
Well, I'm wondering what took the president so long and Mr. Pruitt so long. Clearly, his ethical breaches were so serious. It's hard to understand why the president would allow him to remain as the EPA director. The only thing you can think of is that his actions on following the Trump agenda on EPA was more important than his ethics to the president. So clearly, with his record on ethics violations is very serious, and he never should have been EPA director, and clearly his resignation was long overdue.
Well, I'll note that you opposed his nomination in the first place because of his views on climate change, which he has been skeptical about.
Absolutely, for several reasons. He, of course, filed lawsuits against the Chesapeake Bay program. He has been on the wrong side of climate. He on the wrong side of the U.S. participating with the global community on climate issues. There's a lot of reasons why I felt that from a policy point of view, his views were out of step with what's important to America.
You mentioned the allegations of ethics violations, all of which we should note Scott Pruitt has denied repeatedly. Is that something that your committee will continue to investigate?
Well, clearly, we want to make it clear that ethics are not a suggestion, but a staple of good government. And it's critically important that when you have a position such as Mr. Pruitt's, you must adhere to the strictest ethics standards, which from the beginning he did not.
So again, is that something that your committee will continue to track?
I think our committee needs to make sure that these practices will no longer be tolerated by the EPA or by any of the areas under our committee's jurisdiction.
Let me ask you about Andrew Wheeler. This is the current deputy. He will take over the role as acting head of the EPA next week. He's a former coal lobbyist. Do you support his nomination? Should it be made for the permanent job?
Well, I have difficulty with his policy positions. On his ethics, let me be clear. There's no reason for me to suspect that he has violated ethics issues. All that will be vetted if he is nominated to be the EPA director. At this point, I would hope the president would reach out in the tradition of both Democratic and Republican administrations and appoint the EPA administrator that is committed to protecting our environment.
Last question, and it's a big picture one, but assess the impact that Scott Pruitt has, in fact, had on the EPA during his time there.
Mr. Pruitt was extremely active in carrying out Mr. Trump's commitment to eliminate a lot of our protections for our environment, to make it a lot easier for energy companies to be able to get fossil fuels, including in pristine areas of our country. He was very much engaged in countering what science has taught us in regards to how to protect our environment. So I think his legacy was one of weakening clean air, weakening the clean water.
That is Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. Senator, thanks for your time.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
This week, New York and Virginia become the first two states to require mental health education in public schools. This comes as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report a 30% rise in suicide rates in the U.S. in the past two decades. Virginia State Senator Cree Deeds knows the reality behind these statistics all too well. In 2013, his son repeatedly stabbed him and then killed himself. He was 24 years old. Senator Deeds was one of the sponsors of the new Virginia law, and he joins us now to talk about it. Senator Deeds, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I read that this decision to sponsor this law came after you listened to a presentation from high schoolers in your district.
Yes. You know, I was really blown away by their thoughtfulness, by their passion. These young people had seen bullying in school. They'd seen their peers under pressure who had either died by suicide or come close to dying by suicide. And specifically, they had really pretty well thought out about why it was important to target 9th and 10th graders and why health class was the place to talk about mental health.
And what do you think 9th and 10th graders need to know about mental health?
Okay, they need to know the basics about how mental illness affects a person. They need to know what the warning signs are, what to look for in their peers and themselves. You know, 70% of those people who struggle with mental illness first experience an episode sometime between 14 and 24. So 9th and 10th grade is exactly the right time when people ought to be given the tools they need to be able to understand these illnesses.
It sounds like there was no controversy as to how important this was, but who ultimately would come up with the details of the curriculum?
The Board of Education. The parameters around this were drawn by this legislation, and they're pretty broad parameters, but the details have to be worked out by the Board of Education and have to be built into the curriculum for 9th and 10th graders. And I'm hopeful that some work will be done this summer so we can begin the program in the fall.
And will teachers get additional training to develop more of an expertise in mental health issues?
I think they will have to. I'm very hopeful that some of our institutions of higher learning, when they're training health teachers, mm-hmm. can do a better job of incorporating some awareness of mental illnesses in their curriculum.
But has the state legislature provided extra funds to provide that training?
We haven't done it yet. I mean, at some point this year, we invested more money in mental illness and behavioral health issues than we have ever had before, $192 million over the biennium. So we've taken a major step this year. The last few years, we've done some pretty important things in terms of recognizing what we need to do to provide more services to those people and families that struggle. But we're not where we should be, and very few states are.
As we mentioned, this is obviously an issue that resonates quite deeply and quite personally with you. You said after your son died that the state had failed your son, that he was turned away from an institution before he took his own life. What are some things you feel people still do not understand about mental illness?
Well, at the end of the day, sometimes they don't know how to react to someone who is struggling. And sometimes just our language. There was recently a headline in a local newspaper about a loony bin. Sometimes we just insult those people who struggle. Mental health issues need to be given the same dignity as physical health issues.
Senator Cree Deeds, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Peter Dubois, Artistic Director of the Huntington Theater Company. Remember, you can listen to WBUR on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Comcast Business, providing internet service for businesses that depend on it. Information at comcastbusiness.com. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV built for business.
This is 90.9 WBUR. In business news, Boston Federal Court is the setting for a bitter battle over an ice cream sandwich. Frozen dessert maker 600-pound Gorillas, Inc. claims that another company that supplied the filling for its ice cream sandwiches secretly watered down the recipe and harmed its sales. The other company, Mr. Cookie Face, says that loss cannot be blamed on the sandwich filling. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow was up 181 points. Marketplace will have all the day's business news at 6:30. In our forecast, a break in the humidity is expected tomorrow with some flash flooding along the coast. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
Skies will become cloudy late tonight. Temperatures fall only to the 70s. Showers and thunderstorms likely for tomorrow. They could produce some heavy rain. Flash flood watches up for eastern sections of New England. Temperatures in the 80s, so we stay below 90. Saturday, sunshine, low humidity, upper 70s. Sunday, sunny and warm, a great beach day, mid-80s. Upper 80s Monday and Tuesday with sunshine.
Right now it's 91 degrees in Boston, 78 degrees in Vineyard Haven, and it's 20 past 5.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Rock Auto, an online auto parts store with everything from complex electrical parts for modern daily drivers to new brake shoes for old favorites. More at rockauto.com. And EBSCO, offering Flipster digital magazines for libraries to share knowledge and expand young imaginations. Available via computer, tablet, phone, or the Flipster app. Learn more at flipster.com.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration's practice of separating children and parents at the border was terrifying to many immigrants. Even those who are in the country legally are beginning to wonder that their families could be broken apart, too. As NPR's David Shaper reports, anti-immigrant threats and actions have many Latino Americans living on edge.
Mexican immigrant Sarah has a hard time watching the news these days. In fact, when I ask her about it, the 37-year-old mother of four chokes up immediately and tears stream down her cheeks.
I'm sorry. It's emotional.
The scenes of mothers and children being separated remind Sarah of her own border crossing 15 years ago, when she had to leave her young daughter behind for a time. They were reunited here in Chicago, where Sarah and her husband have since had three more children who are U.S. citizens. Sarah asked that we not use her last name because she now fears more than ever that she and her husband could be deported and their family torn apart. Through an interpreter, she says those constant worries are affecting their health.
Mi esposo es mucho estrés, mucho dolor de cabeza.
There's a lot of stress. My husband's very stressed. He'll sleep for like a little bit and then he'll wake up. He has a lot of headaches and it's hard for me to sleep.
Sarah says her children are feeling the stress and anxiety too.
Para ellos como hijos, que se preocupan qué es lo que va a pasar.
I know what's going on. It's very worrying for them, but on the other hand, we try to just live and keep going, but that's no way to live.
It appears such worries are on the minds of many immigrants these days.
Did you see the news last night?
It's that question Hannah Bonifacius hears almost every day as she teaches English as a second language to immigrants on Chicago's Northwest Side.
Did you see the news last night? And I'd say, which story? And it's always about immigration.
Many immigrants in her classes have fled violence and are already stressed out about finding jobs, housing, and education. So Bonifacius say facing new uncertainties about their legal status here can be traumatizing.
Our current climate is affecting their mental health, for sure.
Mia Fioretto-Rubin is Bonifacius' colleague at the Refugee and Immigrant Resettlement Agency World Relief Chicago and says she sees people walking in every day in a state of crisis. And it's not just those who are undocumented.
We have people who have already naturalized and been citizens for years who have come back to us and asked, could this be taken away from me? The fear is there for every single person who was not born on American soil, and even some people who were born here but to immigrant families. There is the concern that somehow, some way, they're going to be forced to leave.
The biggest fear, says Rubin, is the uncertainty of what's coming next. With new policies implemented in what she calls a capricious way, that fear can quickly turn to panic.
We are absolutely seeing a significant increase in anxiety, depression, all of the physical manifestations of that. Clients reporting to us that they're having severe headaches, an increase in blood pressure.
Por la iglesia, para que llevemos a cabo la misión de Cristo con palabras.
Many in the Latino community try to calm their fears with faith. Here at St. Alexis in the Chicago suburb of Bensonville, parishioners during the Spanish language masses often say prayers for immigrants detained at the border and for political leaders to provide justice. They light more candles before and after Mass, and some kneel and pray at the Grotto of the Sacred Heart in the courtyard outside of church. Father Matthew Nathan, the pastor of St. Alexis, says he's even blessing more religious figurines believed to help protect their families.
The most common statues that I would bless after Mass would be our Virgin of Guadalupe, St. Jude, who is the patron of lost causes, and then I'll always get a St. Michael the Archangel, the defender, the protector of those that are being attacked.
And under attack is exactly how many Latinos here say they feel these days.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, we feel like they're after us.
53-year-old Amelia Chaidez has been a U.S. citizen since coming here as a child. But she says in recent months she feels more eyes following her as she shops. And she points to viral videos of white Americans screaming at Latinos to go back to their country, even when the targets of such vitriol were born here.
I wasn't worried before. I was angry. But right now, I'm beginning to worry. I think they're after us. I really do.
What gives Chaidez and others in the Latino community here hope is the strength they find in their faith, their family, their friends and neighbors, as they pray that the anti-immigrant mood will soon lift. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Top world sporting events such as the World Cup and the Olympics have men's and women's competitions. But cycling's most prestigious race, the Tour de France, which begins Saturday, has no women's competition. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley met a group of cyclists who are riding to change that.
Early this morning in the town of Évry, about 20 miles south of Paris, two large vans were being loaded with bicycles, gear, and equipment. 13 amateur cyclists, all women, were getting ready to head off to the west coast island of Noirmoutier, where the Tour de France begins this year. Marine Thiebaud showed her high-tech bike, which weighs just 16 pounds.
Il est très léger, il est résistant et costaud, c'est du carbone.
It's light and resistant because it's made of carbon, she says, so it's going to climb very well. And it has electronic, not mechanical, gears. These women will make the same grueling climbs up the Alps and Pyrenees as the men. They'll ride the same treacherous cobblestones of Roubaix, all 3 weeks, 2,000 miles of it, one day ahead of the men. They start Friday, not Saturday, and they'll have to contend with traffic because the roads won't be closed off. Their tour is not a race that pits one rider against the other, says Claire Floret, who began the venture 4 years ago.
On considère cette aventure comme certes une aventure sportive, mais aussi une aventure militante et humaine.
We consider it a sporting adventure, but also an activist and human adventure. We're trying to get our message out about the need for a women's tour, so we ride together. We have to be in shape because it's very difficult. But we also have to be engaged activists.
These riders say there are not enough opportunities for female cyclists in France. The Giro d'Italia has a women's race, even if it's shorter than the men's. Mathieu Islay is a trainer for this team. He says cycling and its prejudices are entrenched in France, and there's more equality in places where the sport is newer.
In UK, United States, Australia, there's many race for women professional.
France is behind.
Yes. In France, it's an old country for cycling, but women don't practice cycling in competition.
Islay says things are changing. Every year, this group has more riders, sponsors, and fans. Some 400 cyclists, women and men, rode along on many stages to support the team last year. Ukrainian rider Tetyana Kalachova says she feels buoyed by the fans.
When you come to the mountains, you climb, and you have all these people cheering you up, believing in you, and even though you don't have any more force, you just push on, you just stand up and finish that. So it's an enormous source of energy. That's a great feeling.
The head of the Tour de France said recently that a standalone women's tour is almost inevitable, and the French president of the International Cycling Union said he wants to see a women's Tour de France in place before his term is up in 2021. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And this is 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR News station. Coming up, questions about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's next meetings in North Korea. Our weather forecast is calling for some clouds tonight with temperatures in the 70s, but a break in the humidity tomorrow. Showers, thunderstorms, heavy rain expected tomorrow. Highs will be in the 80s. For Saturday, it'll be sunny with temperatures in the 70s and sunshine on Sunday. Highs in the 80s. 91 degrees right now in Boston.
WBUR supporters include Boston Children's Museum. This summer, explore hands-on exhibits, science, art, music, and games at Boston Children's Museum, Fort Point Channel by the Seaport District.
Down in Georgia, there's this farm filled with 100-year-old pecan trees and millions of pounds of pecan nuts.
Obviously, in this country, we don't have much of an appetite for in-shell pecans the way they do, say, for ballpark peanuts that you shell by hand. Don't have that here. In China, that's really popular, actually.
I'm Molly Wood. So what do you do if China is your biggest customer? That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Scott Pruitt resigned today as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. In a letter to the president, he said he's stepping down effective tomorrow because of what he called unrelenting and unprecedented attacks on him and his family. Pruitt has been the subject of more than a dozen ethics investigations. Pruitt was also a climate change skeptic and a critic of fossil fuel regulations. President Trump reportedly has narrowed his list of Supreme Court candidates to three. NPR's Brian Naylor says all are currently federal judges.
The three remaining candidates are Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, Amy Coney Barrett on the Seventh Circuit, and Raymond Kethledge, who is now on the Sixth Circuit. Sources tell NPR that Kavanaugh and Barrett are for now the leading choices. Kavanaugh has 2 degrees from Yale and is the most experienced of the three, having been on the federal bench for a dozen years. He's supported by establishment conservatives. Barrett, a former law professor at Notre Dame, was named to the appeals court by Trump last year and is a favorite of social conservatives. Sources say Trump could decide as soon as Friday. The president is expected to announce his pick Monday night. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is traveling to North Korea today. It's his first visit there since President Trump and North Korea leader Kim Jong-un met last month in Singapore. NPR's David Wellner reports Pompeo will focus on Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program.
Secretary Pompeo is following up on the joint declaration signed in Singapore that commits North Korea to, quote, work toward complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Pompeo acknowledged that, contrary to President Trump's assertion, North Korea still is a nuclear threat to the U.S.
NPR's David Wellner reporting. Stocks closed higher today. The Dow closed up 181 points. The S&P gained 23. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Becker in Boston. The mayor of Boston says he's angry about the 4th of July shootings in Dorchester that killed one man and hurt four others. WBUR's Quincy Walters reports.
Officials are urging anyone with information about the shootings to come forward. One happened near a party where kids were playing in a bounce house. Mayor Marty Walsh says the people responsible jeopardized young, innocent lives.
If you want to kill each other, it's a horrible thing. And I don't want to stand here as mayor and say, you know, we're justifying that. You kill each other. But what happens is you kill an innocent person and you disrupt a whole community and you send the wrong message to young people. And the thing that's frustrating about it, not one of them are talking.
So far, there have been no arrests. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Quincy Walters.
Meantime, Boston police say officers had to shoot a dog that charged at police who were recovering a gun from the scene of those July 4th shootings. Police say the unleashed pit bull came running toward officers and the dog's owner did not try to secure the animal. The dog's owner, however, is disputing the police account. Lawyers for convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zahar Tsarnaev want access to interview recordings with a man who was killed in a confrontation with the FBI. The recordings involve authorities questioning Ibrahim Tadashev in 2013 about a triple murder in Waltham in 2011. Authorities say Tadashev confessed that he had participated in those murders with Zahar Tsarnaev's older brother Tamerlan. No one has been charged in that triple murder. Tadashev was killed by an FBI agent after that interview. Agents said that they shot him after he charged at them with a metal broom. The Rhode Island Democratic Party is rescinding its endorsement for a candidate who supported President Trump. The party had supported Michael Earnhardt over incumbent Representative Maura Walsh. Earnhardt is a former Republican who did support Donald Trump in 2016. A Brazilian immigrant living in Massachusetts will soon be able to reunite with her son. A federal judge in Chicago has ruled that Surly Paixo can take her son home from federal custody. Federal authorities separated the mother and son 6 weeks ago when they tried to enter the U.S. illegally. In another case, an 8-year-old Guatemalan girl and her mother have been reunited in Boston. They were separated shortly after crossing the border 2 months ago. Officials say a man drowned in Westwood this afternoon. The Westwood Fire Department says a 56-year-old man was swimming with two companions when he drowned at Buckmaster Pond about 2:30 today. A traffic note now. An accident and a vehicle fire on Route 495 South in Haverhill are slowing traffic in both directions. The accident is at Exit 48, which is the Ward Hill Connector. It's about a 4-mile backup right now on 495 heading south. Our weather forecast is calling for some clouds tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Showers tomorrow, highs in the 80s. It's 91 degrees in Boston at 5:35.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from The New York Times, covering issues that affect everyone, including immigration, the Second Amendment, and sexual harassment. Journalists at The New York Times are committed to reporting the facts. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on his way to North Korea, his third known trip there, but his first since President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un agreed to work to completely denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. The two leaders signed a brief statement after their summit last month, 2 pages long. It leaves a lot of questions unanswered. Now, will Pompeo be able to start filling in some of the details? We begin our coverage with Bloomberg reporter Nick Wadhams, who is traveling with the Secretary of State. I asked Nick about Pompeo's itinerary in North Korea.
He arrives at about noon local time on the 6th, and then will be there all the rest of the day, spend the night, and then head out later the next day. So all we know is that there will be a lot of meetings, but we don't have an official schedule yet on who he'll meet.
And that's interesting. He's gonna stay the night in Pyongyang.
That's right. This is the first high-level meeting between U.S. and North Korean officials since the Singapore summit when President Trump met Kim Jong-un.
And I'm just curious, the diplomatic details here. Usually a Secretary of State traveling would stay in the U.S. embassy of a capital city they're visiting. There obviously is no U.S. embassy in Pyongyang. Do you know where he's staying?
There are basically two hotels where North Korea puts foreign visitors. You know, the interesting thing about this and what's going to be so fascinating to watch is that this really hasn't been done at this level in so many years. But so far, we have very precious few details about how this is actually all going to go down.
Fascinating. No protocol to follow because there has been no protocol for so many years in a meeting at this level. All right. So what about the substance of these talks? What has Pompeo laid out as specific goals for this specific meeting?
Well, that's another really interesting thing. They haven't actually publicly laid out what specifically he's going to be doing in Pyongyang. Read that as you may. What we expect, though, is that he's going to start to lay out some sort of timeline under which North Korea would essentially declare what weapons of mass destruction it has, and then begin to start looking ahead to the future to how it would give up those weapons and how the U.S. side would verify that it was doing so. Secretary Pompeo insists that North Korea is genuine in its desire to give up its nuclear weapons, despite deep skepticism from observers and analysts about that.
Do we have any insight into what kind of timeline he's seeking?
Well, we have contradicting messages from this administration. So John Bolton went on the Sunday news shows last week and said that he expected the bulk of this to be done within a year. But that contradicted Secretary Pompeo himself, who said he had no timeline. And then a couple weeks before that told us that he expected the real heavy lifting on this to be done within the president's first term. So we're going into Pyongyang essentially with three timelines. One is no timeline, one is a year, and another is 2.5 years. So the question is, do they have a plan in mind, or are they sort of going along, feeling it out as they go?
Nick Wadhams, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And there are lots more questions about what Secretary Pompeo will be able to accomplish in North Korea and what success would look like down the road. With us now to parse through all of this is David Kang. He directs the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's just step back a little bit. Has the Trump administration made it clear exactly what it expects the North Koreans should give up under this joint statement that the two leaders released last month when they met in Singapore?
No, they haven't. And that's where a lot of the debate or the controversy comes around, because what the United States has claimed it wants is complete denuclearization. And the North Koreans sort of say they'll do that, but it's pretty clear they don't mean the same thing. And so no one's really sure exactly what is on the table.
Has North Korea done anything in the last few weeks that shows it's on board with some of the spirit of what the U.S. might mean by denuclearization?
Well, in the last few weeks, it's come out that North Korea has continued to move forward with proliferation in some ways with their with their nuclear program, right? And so in some ways, that's counter to the spirit. In other ways, there are still the missile test moratorium and the nuclear test moratorium and the dismantling of the nuclear test sites. So they're in a sort of holding pattern, just like I think the way that we are.
Is it realistic to expect North Korea to make any concessions if the U.S. hasn't been altogether clear about what it's willing to do to help North Korea?
No, it's not. And that's one of the things that we tend to overlook, which is we're all focused on what North Korea is going to do, and they haven't made enough concessions, or what do they really mean? But it's not clear what the United States will do. We canceled one war game, one military exercise.
Right.
We can always start those up again. Beyond that, it's not clear what the U.S. means by a peace treaty, by economic aid, et cetera, et cetera. So the North Koreans, I think, are looking to see what the U.S. really means, and the U.S. is looking at what the North Koreans really mean, and that's why you engage in diplomacy.
If we take Secretary Pompeo at his word, as you just heard, all of this is going to be done in Trump's first term. What do you think? Is that realistic?
It's realistic if you define success so that we already meet the bar, right? And this is the question again. The dirty secret or the open common knowledge is that there will never be complete denuclearization of North Korea because they can always start over again. So the real question that we should have for ourselves is, can we move the needle in the right direction, and can we keep it going that way? And in that sense, compared to where we were literally 1 year ago, we are so much better off. A year ago, we were testing missiles and fire and fury, and everyone was really worried.
How much could the needle actually move by the end of Trump's first term? We're talking about 2.5 years from now. What do you see can be realistically accomplished in that time frame?
You know, I think if North Korea actually takes one or two more steps backwards, for example, allowing in some inspectors or even turning over some nuclear weapons or something like that, that would be huge. Most people don't expect them to even do that. On the U.S. side, the real question is, what would we do? Maximum pressure is still in effect. You know, economic sanctions, threats that we can always go back to, more military exercises. So is the U.S. really prepared to walk back a number of those sanctions and to move forward with some kind of actual peace treaty? It's not clear, but that's what would be success.
So what do you expect to come out of this meeting between Secretary Pompeo and the North Koreans?
I think a optimistic outcome would be that both the U.S. and North Korea make some kind of specific commitment to some step. That would be success, meaning North Korea says, okay, we've done X and Y, and now we will dismantle something, whatever. And the United States comes out and says, this is our next step. We now will do X or Y. This is what diplomacy is about trying to push forward. And it's not clear at all what either side really wants to give, but both sides are aimed in the right direction, at least. And last year, we weren't.
David Kong teaches Korean studies at USC. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow, the Trump administration is imposing tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese imports. As a result, hundreds of products could become more expensive. The administration says it is targeting unfair trading practices by Chinese companies. But according to researchers, most of the companies affected by the U.S. tariffs aren't even Chinese. NPR's Jim Ciroli reports.
Joe Cohen started designing power snow shovels in high school. He was soon selling them on the home shopping channel QVC, where his products became something of a fixture.
This has got to be the most easy, convenient, by the way, he'll show you how little it weighs in a second, snowblower to own and use. And
today, the company Cohen started, called Snowjo, sells 700 different home and garden products. They're designed in New Jersey, but mostly made overseas.
I mean, there's just no other alternative. If there was a source in, you know, somewhere here, well, absolutely it makes sense to produce it. But there are none.
Some of the products Cohen sells are made in China. They include garden tillers and cultivators, which are included on the Trump administration's tariff list.
We're going to do everything in our power to maintain our cost to our retailers and ultimately the retail price. But 25% is a really big number. Sooner or later, unfortunately, the price will ultimately go up and consumers will pay more for it.
The company's plight underscores the unintended consequences of the tariff war between the United States and its trading partners. Mary Lovely, professor of economics at Syracuse University, says U.S. tariffs may be aimed at China, but in a recent report, she said, most of the companies that will be hurt are not Chinese. That's partly because of how intertwined global supply chains have become. For example, Lovely says other countries still buy elevators made in America.
The U.S. is able to make elevators successfully partly by importing some of the less skill-intensive parts and then assembling those elevators here in the United States and then exporting those elevators to the rest of the world.
Lovely says a lot of the items targeted for tariffs are parts and pieces of products that are imported from China and assembled into finished goods in other countries.
60% of all the trade between U.S. and China actually takes place through these multinational supply chains.
Because the tariffs are hidden inside these complex supply chains, consumers won't see price increases right away. But they will eventually. Mabuchi Motor is a Japanese company that makes small motors used in autos and medical devices. The motors Mabuchi makes in China are on the U.S. tariff list. Ann Hof is treasurer of the company's U.S. distribution arm. She says Mabuchi will have to pass on the cost of the tariffs to its customers, the auto and medical companies that it sells to.
They're going to simply pass that cost on to their customers,
which in many cases is the U.S. consumer. This isn't going to hurt China. This is going to hurt us.
Hof says the company could leave China and find another country to make motors in, but that would take a while.
I mean, this could take 2 to 3 years before we are up and running with a new line. That's just not practical right now.
And even if it wanted to relocate, it's not clear where Mobuchi could go. The company also uses a factory in Mexico for some of its manufacturing. It can bring the products it makes there into the United States because of the North American Free Trade Agreement. But with President Trump renegotiating NAFTA, it's not clear how long it will be able to use that plant either. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
And this is 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on All Things Considered, in a new book, astrophysicist Adam Frank studies other planets to get insight into Earth's future. Maybe your car or your boat's been great, but if it's time to replace one of them, how about donating it to WBUR? The station gets top dollar, you'll be supporting the news, and you may get a tax deduction. Learn how at wbur.org/cars. And thank you. Our weather forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Showers tomorrow, highs in the 80s. We could see some flash flooding tomorrow as well. And for Saturday, sunny, highs in the 70s. Sunday, sunshine, highs in the 80s. It's 90 degrees in Boston at 11 minutes before 6.
The Trump administration's tariffs on foreign steel are supposed to help the steel industry here in the U.S., but they could backfire.
So the U.S. companies, they're allowed to raise their prices to be in that same ballpark. So if the price is up for steel coming in, the price will go up here in the U.S.
And that could hit steel sales and steel jobs. The unintended consequences of steel tariffs, tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. What life is out there in the universe beyond our planet? And how long can we sustain life on Earth? These are the two big questions at the center of astrophysicist Adam Frank's new book. It's called Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. So, Adam, we got a two-hour show here, plenty of time to cover what all known and unknown universes, our collective destiny, the fate of the planet. You're up for that, right?
Yeah, we can get through it really quick, I'm
there
sure.
There we go. Let me start with this number that I read and then went back and reread to see if I had gotten it right. You say that the odds that we, meaning Earthlings, that we are all alone and always were, you put those odds at 1 in 10 billion trillion, meaning you're pretty darn persuaded that there have been other civilizations out there. Persuade
Absolutely.
Me why.
Well, so, you know, even 30 years ago, we did not know whether there were any planets around any other stars in the universe. And, of course, we believe that planets are, you know, the first essential step to getting life and civilizations. But in the last 20 years, we've undergone this amazing revolution in astronomy where we now know that every star you see in the sky has planets going around it. And that, you know, if you count up five of them, one of them has a planet in the right place for life to form. So when you add up all the possibilities in the universe, you end up with 10 billion trillion planets where a civilization could have formed. So that's a lot of experiments that the universe has been able to run. And the idea that none of them except ours went all the way to developing a civilization, you know, kind of strains it a bit. So that's why I think that, you know, we are not, unless the universe is really biased against it, what's happening here has happened before.
If you're right, and what's happening here has happened before or is happening right now somewhere in a galaxy far, far away, what can life on other worlds tell us about our own fate?
Well, this really relates to climate change and what this new era that we've pushed the Earth into that people call the Anthropocene, the human-dominated era. And so, you know, as obviously this is a point of contention in politics a lot about the debate, but in science, you know, we've known for quite a while that we've been changing the planet. And from this perspective, what you realize, if you see that there's been many other civilizations, we're not the first, all of them probably push their planets into some era of climate change, that it's almost inevitable if you build a world-girdling civilization that's sucking up a huge amount of energy, that they will all push their planets into climate change. And then the question is, does anybody make it? Does anybody make it to sustainability?
Right. The idea, as you put it, is basically that if there have been advanced societies out there that have developed, that they would be changing their climates and perhaps have self-destructed?
Well, that's the question. So, you know, for me, this perspective, what I call the astrobiological perspective, the kind of cosmic perspective on civilizations in the universe, it changes everything about how we think about climate change. We often think we have to, you know, sort of prove to people that we've triggered climate change. From this perspective, that question doesn't even really exist. It's of course we triggered it. Any civilization that emerges, a technological civilization that emerges on a planet, is really a mechanism for harvesting energy and doing something interesting with it, right? Building your civilization, buildings, whatever. And what we really find from when you consider that is that there's no way for the planet not to respond. So on Earth, we are consuming almost a quarter of the total power that the entire biosphere, the entire collection of life, all the trees and microbes, we consume a quarter of that. How could there not be an effect, right? How could the planet not notice that we're there? So then the question becomes, can anybody make it to sustainability? Can any civilization navigate its transition, its climate change transition, and make it through to the other side where you have a long-term relationship with the planet and you're not wiped out?
So this is, in a way, I mean, it sounds totally terrifying to think that maybe other societies have been out there, been through this, and we don't know about them because they managed to exterminate themselves. On the other hand, this is a comforting message, maybe, right? That we don't need to have quite the angst about climate change as a political issue, because this is completely to have been expected. And the challenge now is, all right, what do we do going forward?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the way this perspective really changes the story we tell. What I like to say is that you can't solve a problem until you understand it, and you can't understand it until you know how to tell its story. And when it comes to climate change, we've been telling the wrong story. And part of that story is that we stink, right? Human beings are a plague on the planet. We're horrible. We're greedy. And look, God knows human beings can do horrible things, but in this respect, triggering climate change was not our fault, right? We've been using energy since for 10,000 years in any form we could find, animal dung, animals themselves, to power civilization. And when we discovered oil, it's not like we, you know, twirled our mustaches and said, "I will destroy the planet." Instead, we used it to do amazing things, heating homes, making internal combustion engines. So triggering climate change was not our fault, but not doing something about it now that we've recognized it, not switching energy infrastructures now that we've recognized it. Yeah, not only would that be our fault, but it would be our folly, because what it would mean is that would be the reason why we didn't make it across the other side. Some civilizations make it and some don't, and that would be the reason why we wouldn't make it.
But again, is all of this completely hypothetical? I mean, we have no actual proof of other civilizations out there.
Part of this revolution in astrobiology and thinking about life and planets together, which we only are just learning how to do, is to look at the history of the Earth, right? The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There's been life on it for at least around 4 billion or so. And the Earth has been many different planets, right? For a while, the Earth was a water world. There weren't any continents on there. And there's been times when the Earth has been a snowball world, almost entirely encased in ice. It's been a jungle planet. There was a time when there was no oxygen in the atmosphere, a long period, even when there was life. And it was life itself, microbes, that through their own living processes made the atmosphere oxygen rich. And we wouldn't be there without that. All of those have lessons for us about how we have to reintegrate ourselves as part of the biosphere. We've sort of grown up thinking that we're different from the biosphere. And the lesson of this long view, including thinking about possible other civilizations, is that any civilization that makes it has to reintegrate itself back into the biosphere. You can't just push the biosphere around and expect it's not going to feed back on you. So the real perspective that we gain is we are what the biosphere is doing now. Just as like on other planets that have grown civilizations, that will be what their biospheres were doing. Just like on our planet, you know, there was grasslands. That was the experiment the biosphere was running a while ago. Dinosaurs were an experiment the biosphere was running a long time ago. Mm. We're what the biosphere is doing now, but it doesn't mean we're what the biosphere is going to be doing 10,000 years from now.
Adam Frank, thanks very much.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Adam Frank, professor at the University of Rochester, also an occasional contributor for our show, and we have been talking about his new book. It is titled Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR Boston and from Trader Joe's, offering a new 5-part podcast series, Inside Trader Joe's, with the story behind Trader Joe's bananas, plus a tasting panel and a visit to Paris for Madeleine. Available now. More at TraderJoe's.com. Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com. And the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at kendedafund.org.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Our forecast is calling for partly cloudy skies tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Tomorrow, showers, thunderstorms, some flash flooding is likely along the coast tomorrow. Highs will be in the 80s. For Saturday, it'll be sunny, temperatures in the 70s, and sunshine on Sunday with highs in the 80s. It is 91 degrees right now in Boston. It's 90 degrees in Beverly, and it's 81 in Hyannis at 6 o'clock. From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom. 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. President Trump says he's accepted the resignation of Scott Pruitt, the embattled head of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's Thursday, July 5th. This is WBUR's All Things Considered. Good evening. I'm Deborah Becker. Coming up this hour, a look at Scott Pruitt's history with the EPA and why he decided to step down now after repeatedly denying any wrongdoing.
Much of what has been targeted towards me and my team has been half-truths or, at best, stories that have been so twisted they do not resemble reality.
Also this hour, federal officials say less than 3,000 children are believed to have been separated from their parents at the U.S. border. Plus, in a Virginia county where the coal industry once thrived, jobs are now scarce. Marketplace has the business news at 6:30. It's 6:01.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Former Fox News executive Bill Shine is taking a job at the White House. NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Trump named Shine his deputy chief of staff for communications.
The Trump administration has been without a full-time communications manager since Hope Hicks left the White House 3 months ago. Bill Shine is expected to fill that messaging role, but his title, Deputy Chief of Staff and Assistant to the President, suggests a broader range of responsibilities. In announcing the appointment, rumored for more than a week, Trump said Shine would bring decades of experience to the role. Shine was co-president of Fox News until his departure last year amid a series of sexual harassment scandals. Shine himself was never accused of harassment, though some Fox employees said he turned a blind eye to it and tried to suppress their complaints. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
President Trump announced via Twitter today he's accepted the resignation of embattled EPA head Scott Pruitt. Trump praising Pruitt for an outstanding job and saying Deputy Andrew Wheeler will take over as acting administrator effective Monday. Some White House advisors have been growing increasingly frustrated with Pruitt, who came under fire for a wide range of ethics questions, including spending abuses, first-class travel, and a seemingly cozy relationship with lobbyists. However, the former Oklahoma Attorney General was hailed as a hero by some conservatives due to his aggressive stance on deregulation. Two more people are hospitalized in critical condition in Britain after being exposed to the Cold War-era nerve agent Novichok. It's the same toxin that nearly killed a former Russian spy and his daughter in March. NPR's Alice Fordham has an update from London.
Following an emergency meeting of high-level officials, Interior Minister Sajid Javid told lawmakers two more people had been poisoned by Novichok near the town of Salisbury, where a former Russian agent and his daughter were exposed to the nerve agent and nearly died earlier in the year. Javid blamed Russia for both incidents.
It is now time that the Russian state comes forward and explains exactly what has gone on.
Members of Parliament sought assurances that members of the public would be safe. Javid and the police do not know how the two came into contact with the substance, which remains potent for months and can be fatal even in very small quantities. Alice Fordham, NPR News, London.
Members of the Federal Reserve Board's Open Market Committee at their June meeting discussed whether a recession might be in the cards, while at the same time apparently expressing doubts global trade tensions could hit the economy, which by most measures appears to still be growing. Minutes from the Fed's two-day meeting in Washington in June generally gave the impression the central bank is confident with its plans to continue raising interest rates in the near term. An up session on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 181 points to close at 24,356. The Nasdaq closed up 83 points. The Standard & Poor's 500 gained 23 points today. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good evening. I'm Deborah Becker in Boston. A woman who is seeking asylum from Guatemala and her 8-year-old daughter have been reunited at Logan Airport. WBUR's Fred Tice was on hand when the two saw each other for the first time since Mother's Day.
The two were very emotional, crying, and really happy to be reunited. It's been about 2 months since they were separated at the border. When Angelica Gonzalez Garcia was told that her daughter would be taken from her at the border, an officer had replied by saying, "Happy Mother's Day."
That's WBUR's Fred Tice at Logan Airport today. Massachusetts lawmakers are weighing in on the resignation of federal EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. In a tweet, Senator Ed Markey says it's, quote, about damn time. Senator Elizabeth Warren said Pruitt should have resigned 28 scandals ago, and Congressman Jim McGovern says Pruitt never should have been appointed in the first place. Representative Michael Capuano says the EPA head's resignation today is long overdue. Harvard University's recently retired president is now on the board of directors at Goldman Sachs. Drew Faust joins the investment banking company after overseeing Harvard for 11 years. She's the third woman on the 12-person board. Larry Bacow replaced Faust at Harvard earlier this week. Tufts Health Plan says it's going to be the first insurer in Massachusetts to share drug rebates directly with members. The president of commercial products for Tufts, Mark Bacon, says the savings could be substantial, perhaps $100 for a $500 arthritis medicine. He also says it's going to help patients avoid taking drastic steps on their own to try to reduce costs.
Some of them split their drugs or they take them every other day, and that doesn't have the outcome that obviously we want to achieve. So this is another way to help people have access to the drugs they need.
The discounts will be limited to members with high deductible plans. More white sharks have been spotted off the coast of Cape Cod. The Atlantic White Shark Conservancy says there were confirmed sightings off Provincetown and Orleans today. Today's sightings mean that great white sharks have been spotted off Cape Cod beaches 3 out of 4 days. Since Monday. Our weather forecast is calling for some clouds tonight with temperatures in the 70s. Showers tomorrow, highs in the 80s. Saturday, sunshine, temperatures in the upper 70s. It's 90 degrees right now in Boston at 7 minutes past six.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Pew Charitable Trusts, marking 70 years of nonpartisan research and data. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/70.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The embattled administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency is out. President Trump says he's accepted Scott Pruitt's resignation. This comes after months of ethical scandals. Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, will take over the agency in an acting capacity on Monday. And now to talk about these latest developments, we are joined by NPR's Scott Horsley, who's at the White House. Hey, Scott.
Good to be with you, Elsa.
So the president broke this news on Twitter this afternoon. How exactly did he word this announcement?
He put out a pair of tweets saying he has accepted Pruitt's resignation and that he will always be thankful for Pruitt's service at the EPA. As you mentioned, he has tapped Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, who is a former coal lobbyist, to take over the agency in an acting capacity next week. And Trump added, "We have made tremendous progress, and the future of the EPA is bright." Now, under this administration, the EPA has been steadily rolling back environmental regulations, weakening efforts to address climate change. Pruitt, like the president, was skeptical about the overwhelming scientific consensus that climate change is occurring and that human activity, namely greenhouse gases, is a major contributor.
Right. Pruitt was also and has been under investigation for months for various ethical lapses, the sort of thing that took down other cabinet secretaries much more quickly. Pruitt denied and denied these allegations. Here's what he told Congress back in April.
"Facts are facts and fiction is fiction. And a lie doesn't become truth just because it appears on the front page of the newspaper. Much of what has been targeted towards me and my team has been half-truths or, at best, stories that have been so twisted that they do not resemble reality."
So how did Pruitt survive as long as he did?
Well, because he was aggressively carrying out the president's deregulatory agenda. Scott Pruitt was tailor-made to carry out that agenda of unwinding Obama-era policies. He had fought aggressively against those policies in his old job as attorney general in the fossil fuel-rich state of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
When Trump announced he was pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords last year, it was Scott Pruitt who was at his side in the Rose Garden. And then Pruitt later dined out at a swanky French restaurant here in Washington. So, you know, for a long time, Trump was willing to overlook the mounting ethical scandals, whether it was the sweetheart housing deal in a condo owned by the wife of a lobbyist, or Pruitt's lavish spending on air travel, his 24-hour security detail that accompanied him to the Rose Bowl and other events. You know, for months now, the White House had said those things were troubling, but they liked what Pruitt was doing at the EPA. And as late as this afternoon, the president was tweeting that within the agency, Pruitt had done an outstanding job.
What does Pruitt's departure mean for the overall direction of the EPA going forward now?
It probably doesn't mean much change. In his tweet this afternoon, the president said, "I have no doubt that Andy Wheeler will continue on with our great and lasting EPA agenda." Now, Wheeler is more of a Washington insider than Pruitt was. He is probably savvy enough to sort of fly a little more below the radar. He won't be quite so in your face, and he probably won't try to use agency resources to carry, you know, line his own pockets. But he has been a coal lobbyist. So when it comes to the climate agenda, he will be very much on the same page as Scott Pruitt and the same page as President Trump.
All right. That's NPR's Scott Horsley at the White House. Thank you very much, Scott.
Good to be with you.
Joining us now for more is former EPA Chief Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the role under President George W. Bush. Welcome.
Oh, that's glad to be with you.
So what did you make of this resignation announcement? Were you surprised or had you seen this coming for months?
Oh, this is way overdue. I mean, both for the agency and for the administration. He's been an embarrassment. Never known an administrator, anyone in a position of a cabinet officer to have these many investigations, ethical issues. He's been ethically tone deaf for a long time. So I'm not surprised. I'm just surprised it took this long.
During his time at the EPA, you know, he's been, as you say, at the center of many controversies. But when you look back on the policies during his tenure, was there any particular policy that concerned you the most?
Well, it's the overall attitude, and I'm afraid that's not going to change because that's really determined by the president. I mean, as a cabinet member, you serve at his pleasure, you do what he wants done. And I'm not sure that I think the assistant administrator is going to be any more kind to the environment. I've been worried, first of all, the ethical issues in that whole cloud and the secrecy that surrounded Scott Pruitt with the way he handled things had a very bad atmosphere in the agency. But the denigration of science, the unwillingness to consider any science that didn't adhere to policy that they wanted, the willingness to wholeheartedly accept whatever industry said. Industry should be heard, but they can't be the only voice at the table. And that, I'm afraid, I hope it will change with the acting administrator Wheeler, but there are no guarantees.
Andrew Wheeler is a former coal lobbyist, so it's not much in terms of taking a different tack from industry having a say, I suppose.
No, I'm afraid not. And that's not good for any of us. It's not good for our health. It's not good for the future.
You have said that the EPA is an agency where politics should never come into play. Why is that?
Well, you say it should never. It always does to a degree. But
I was going to ask you if it's possible for politics to not come into play at some point.
Well, it's hard to say never, but it shouldn't be the dominant force, because what you're about is basing decisions on scientific analysis of what's safe for human consumption, what is going to keep us healthy, what's going to protect our environment so that we can live the quality of life we want. And that's based on science. Now, of course, you can argue with the scientists, and everybody does, as we've seen a lot of that recently. So you have to go with the preponderance, and you'll say, okay, then politics get into it, how far you're willing to go. Everybody complained about the Obama administration overutilizing the tools of executive actions.
Mm-hmm.
They'd argue that it's because they couldn't get anything through Congress, but then you're getting politics. So politics will be there, at least in the overall approach to environment, but the basic decisions as to how much lead a child can ingest before it has brain damage is pretty basic, and that's scientific. That's not political.
But given some of the vociferous criticisms of the EPA's direction during the Obama administration, is there any particular direction under Scott Pruitt that you saw the EPA take that you did agree with, that you would applaud?
Well, I certainly agree that regulation should be revisited, but there wasn't much in actual policy that I saw that I could support wholeheartedly. The idea of rethinking regulation, yes, that's not, to me, a problem, if it's done right.
Christine Todd Whitman is the former administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're now going to turn to Myron Ebell. He led Donald Trump's EPA transition team, and he's on the line with us now. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Elsa.
So you gave recommendations to the Trump transition personnel team for who should lead the EPA, and Scott Pruitt was on that list. Do you still stand by that recommendation?
I think he was a good choice. To just be frank, he wasn't my very top choice, but he was certainly in my short list. I think he's done a good job, and I think he's gotten caught up in a really orchestrated campaign, which took a very few careless missteps and then added on a whole lot of very trivial accusations to try to make it look like he is somehow personally corrupt, and I don't buy any of that.
I want to read to you from Pruitt's resignation letter. He said, quote, "The unrelenting attacks on me personally, my family, are unprecedented and have taken a sizable toll on all of us," end quote. He doesn't really apologize for the long list of controversies during his tenure, the accusations about the secret phone booth, the first-class flights, the sirens to his restaurant reservations. What do you make of that choice, to not apologize for any of those scandals, those controversies?
Oh, it just seems to me that that's what's usually done, and I think he has some good reasons to feel somewhat bitter about this campaign that's been waged against him. You know, similar charges have been brought against previous officials in previous administrations, and they've just died after one or two days.
With Scott Pruitt, there was sort of a drip, drip, drip of scandal after scandal for months and months. It wasn't just one or two discrete things that happened.
Yes, but I think many of the accusations and charges were really trivial. So, this is all water under the bridge now. I think he's done an outstanding job. I think he made some careless missteps, which I think, he should have been better prepared to handle some of the aspects of the job. I don't think it was appropriate to fly first class. Business executives do it all the time, but government officials are expected to fly economy. So, I think he made some mistakes, but I think he's done an outstanding job. And now the question is, what happens to the, President Trump's agenda? And I think it's in good hands with Andrew Wheeler, and we'll move on.
Well, do you worry, though, that all this controversy, Pruitt's departure, will in some way hurt the president's agenda when it comes to environmental regulations? Pruitt's replacement will surely face a very, very tough fight in the Senate because Democrats have been pretty fed up with Pruitt for quite some time now.
Yes, I think it does endanger the president's agenda. But I think the good news is President Trump is very determined to achieve his agenda. He's very clear for EPA what it is. And the person he's named as acting administrator, Andrew Wheeler, who's currently the number two person at EPA, is someone who is fully on board and engaged with this agenda and supports it, I believe, right down the line.
But what legacy do you think Pruitt leaves behind at the EPA? I mean, he basically did what he came to do, right?
Yes. His job was to implement President Trump's agenda, and I think he's done an outstanding job of doing that. I think his legacy is, unfortunately, the same as the last person and the only other EPA administrator who ever tried to reform the EPA, and that was Ann Gorsuch, President Reagan's choice, way back in 1981 when the EPA was only 11 years old. She was run out of town by the Democrats in Congress, and now Scott Pruitt has been run out of town under somewhat different circumstances.
That's Myron Ebell. He's the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Leo Kakunis here from Cranberry Bog Tours. Don't forget, you can listen to WBUR on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up, in a Virginia county where the coal industry once thrived, jobs there are now extremely scarce. In business news, the first company seeking a license to sell recreational marijuana in Worcester has submitted all of its paperwork to the state. Hedico LLC has applied to cultivate marijuana in Worcester. Of the 63 license applications that the state is reviewing, 16 are in Worcester County, and that's the most of any Massachusetts county. Earlier this week, the state granted the first recreational license to a company in Leicester, which is near Worcester. On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow was up 181 points to close at 24,356. The NASDAQ was up 84 points. The S&P 500 was up 23. Marketplace will have all the day's business news at 6:30. In our forecast, WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein says heavy rain tomorrow, but a dry weekend.
Warm overnight as temperatures fall from their highs, which were in the 90s, down only to the 70s with all that humidity. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms the first part of the day. We may see some clearing by sunset. Temperatures in the 80s. Humidity will drop after 5 p.m. For Saturday, sunshine. Temperatures in the mid to upper 70s. Sunday, mostly sunny. Temperatures in the mid 80s. Low humidity as well. Monday and Tuesday, 85 to 90, but it will be moderate in terms of levels of humidity.
It is 90 degrees right now in Boston, 78 in Vineyard Haven at 20 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Massachusetts Historical Society, showing brilliantly crafted works by 19th century Boston furniture makers Isaac Vose and Thomas Seymour. More at masshist.org. And Shakespeare and Company, Lenox, Massachusetts, presenting Macbeth, Shakespeare's gripping tale of blind ambition, through August 5th, shakespeare.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump has promised to bring back coal, but the chances of a young person in central Appalachia getting a job in coal are still pretty slim. That's even though there has been a spike in the price of metallurgical coal, the kind that's used to make steel. That spike has resulted in a few more coal jobs. For the Embedded podcast, Kelly McEvers and Chris Benderev spent a year and a half following several young people in the region who, once they decided not to work in coal, faced some very hard choices. Here is the story of one of them.
When we went to Central Appalachia, we always stayed at this one hotel in Buchanan County, Virginia. And that's where we first meet Brad Pennington in late 2016. Brad works the front desk.
Yeah, well, I mean, the lobby looks like it's part of the Golden Girls set, so yeah.
Brad's kind of darkly sarcastic, but thoughtful. He tells us how fun it was to grow up here, hunting and fishing and riding four-wheelers in the mountains. But, he says, being an adult here isn't easy.
When did you start to realize that fact?
You figure it out pretty quick. I applied for quite a few jobs senior year of high school, and only one I got was Walmart, and that was temp work through winter.
After Walmart, Brad tried community college, then dropped out. Worked in a scrapyard after that, and then for a little while as a security guard at a coal mine. But then a guy died in the mine, and Brad got spooked. And he heard layoffs were coming, so he quit. Brad's dad worked in coal, but he hurt his back doing it.
And he told me from the very beginning, just don't do it. Just go somewhere else. Do anything else.
So Brad got this hotel job. At this point, he works the night shift, makes $8 an hour. He lives at home with his parents. He's single. And most of his high school friends have left the county.
There's nothing here in Buchanan County. It's slowly dying.
How does that feel?
God scares the out of you, if you don't mind me saying that. I mean, it really does. I mean, if you got fired tomorrow or quit tomorrow, there's absolutely no opportunity to get another one. I mean, you're fighting 50 other people on a list a mile long to get a minimum wage job anymore. I mean, you get a job, you keep it, because you know you got to.
But even if there are more coal jobs now in his hometown, Brad thinks that this upturn in metallurgical coal is just a blip in the boom and bust cycle. He doesn't agree with his friends and relatives who think that coal is going to make some big comeback.
It is a dying industry, and you can't keep propping it up and hoping for it to last forever, because it won't. And they know that, but they don't care. They just want it to work right here, right now, so they can live happy and have their money and whatever. And they would rather save 50 jobs for 5 years versus create 500 jobs in 10 years. You know, they're just a lot of hard-headed people around here that here we're going to bring back coal and they're all for it.
So Brad thinks that at this point, the best thing that he can do is to leave this job, this county, the whole thing.
And eventually he does leave. He gets a better paying job delivering Pepsi to gas stations and grocery stores, and he gets an apartment about an hour away. He calls and texts to tell us how he's doing. But then, a year after we first meet him, this past spring, we go back to the hotel and we're surprised. Standing there, again, at the front desk, wearing the same corporate light blue polo shirt he was wearing when we met him, is Brad. He's not looking happy.
So what happened to Pepsi? Like, what happened?
My direct supervisor...
Brad says he and his boss did not get along. Boss would criticize little mistakes, things Brad didn't think should be a big deal, but...
With me, it was a fireable offense, you know.
Finally, Brad's boss called him into the office and told him that he was fired. And Brad panicked. Because he still had to pay rent and heat and water and gas and cable and internet and food for the kitten that he just adopted with his girlfriend. He needed a job. Immediately. So after getting fired, he called up the hotel. And even though it is a place that he does not want to work, he asked for his job back.
I got fired on a Tuesday, and by Tuesday night I was working here. I'd go to Walmart and work if I knew I could pull enough hours to cover my bills, but that's the problem with Walmart. There's no guarantee you're going to pull 20 hours, let alone 36 hours. I'm not going to work under that uncertainty. I got too many bills to pay.
And did you have to take a pay cut to come back here?
Oh, big time. I make less now than I did when I quit, because I quit and come back.
Brad is making less than he was when we first met him a year ago, and he's doing the same job. His girlfriend, who works at a supermarket, pays for groceries.
Because I can never afford it, you know. I'm tapped out paying the rent and my truck payments. And then I buy gas for both our cars.
So so you can cover all that stuff, like you said.
But it's the skin of our teeth, basically. Okay. I mean, it's getting tough.
Really?
To this point, yeah.
Have there been times recently you were really worried?
And oh, yeah. A lot of times.
What does that feel like or sound like or look like? Or
it's not fun. It's not fun.
I'm sorry.
I'm okay. I still don't like thinking about it. It just is. It's tough. I mean, I make less than $8 an hour here, so.
Less than.
And that kind of stuff just hits me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as I'm alone, I was doing good. Which I still am, but not as good.
Over the next few months, Brad spends his time searching, and sometimes interviewing, for better jobs. Meter reader at the power company, cable guy. Those didn't work out. But then, this one did.
Thank you for calling. This is Brad. May I get the account number or the phone number you were contacting us about today?
It's at a call center, and it pays $10.25 an hour, which is more than the hotel.
Call center jobs are the kinds of jobs people in the area like to point to as a possible replacement for coal jobs. This job pays a lot less than coal. It's enough to get by, but it's not enough for Brad to move away, maybe go to college, and have a better life. For Embedded, I'm Kelly McEvers.
And I'm Chris Benderev.
A golden retriever named Sam has gone to his final reward without spilling the beans.
Sam played Duke, Jay Bush's crafty canine companion, in the ads for Bush's baked beans.
The running gag, Duke knows the secret to the company's recipe and claims he'll stay mum.
You can trust me, Jay.
I know, boy, but I'm not taking any chances.
Bush Brothers and Company confirmed Sam's death. He was just one of the several Goldens who played Duke over the years.
But why use a dog to sell beans? After all, many vets say baked beans aren't good for dogs.
Well, Jay Bush, that would be the great-grandson of the company's founder, really had a golden retriever named Duke. And in the mid-1990s, when Bush's baked beans needed a new advertising campaign, they decided to capitalize on Jay and Duke's relationship.
People love dogs. People love beans.
The real Duke, though, was not up to snuff, a little camera shy. Here's company marketing VP Jennifer Podaski.
We require our Dukes to be great actors, and we wanted to make sure family dogs could remain as family dogs.
So they called in the canine actors, including Sam.
Podaski says despite Sam's death, the tradition of Duke will live on.
Bush's secret family recipe for sale.
Duke! Duke! Did you have something to do with this?
Right, Jay. I'm running a printing press in my basement.
This is NPR News.
And this is 90.9 WBUR. Forecast is calling for some clouds tonight with temperatures in the 70s, showers tomorrow, thunderstorms. Some flash flooding is likely in coastal areas tomorrow. Highs will be in the 80s. For Saturday, sunny. Temperatures in the 70s and sunshine on Sunday with highs in the 80s. It is 90 degrees still in Boston at 6:30. Stay with us. Marketplace is next.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Hospital, U.S. News & World Report's number one pediatric hospital 5 years in a row. Learn about families who inspire at bostonchildrens.org/inspire. And MEFA, with low-cost undergrad and graduate student loans with fixed interest rates and multiple repayment options to help cover the cost of college. Easily apply online in just minutes. MEFA, the authority you can trust to help you pay for college. MEFA.org.